Audio Scholar is pleased to present Essays by Carl Sagan. Your reader is Julian Lopez Morillas. Executive producer is Lawrence Bauman. Carl Sagan was the David Duncan Professor of Astronomy and Space Sciences and Director of the Laboratory for Planetary Studies at Cornell University. As advisor to NASA, he played a leading role in the American space program since its inception. He was also a recipient of the Public Welfare Medal, the highest award of the National Academy of the Sciences. Dr. Sagan was a Pulitzer Prize winner for his book Dragons of Eden, and the author of many bestsellers, including Cosmos, which became the best-selling science book ever published in the English language. He received 22 honorary degrees from American colleges and universities for his contributions to science, literature, education, and the preservation of the environment. In its posthumous Distinguished Public Service Award to Dr. Sagan, the National Science Foundation declared that his research transformed planetary science. His gifts to mankind were infinite. And now, Essays by Carl Sagan. Foreword. Astronomy is the study of everything, with the sole exception of the planet Earth and what lies in it and on it. Because the universe is so vast and the Earth so tiny, the exception is a trivial one, although understandably important for us. In its infancy and early childhood, astronomy was necessarily restricted to that tiny volume of the cosmos that could be made out with the naked eye: the sun, the moon, 5 planets, some stars, and an occasional meteor or comet. Only a few thousand stars are bright enough to be seen unaided, even by individuals with excellent eyesight. You could estimate the brightness and relative positions of the stars and planets, the sun and moon, look for regularities in their motion, and try to predict when a given configuration of bodies might repeat, perhaps in the far future. We were painfully ignorant even of what these celestial bodies were made of and why they moved. We invested them with mystical and superstitious fancies of which contemporary astrology is a living fossil. Progress was slow, in part because certain views were unacceptable to the religious authorities. Nevertheless, the regularities in the apparent motions in the heavens were so striking that over the millennia they called out for an explanation, an understanding of the celestial clockwork that made it all go. This endeavor of astronomers in many nations and historical epochs, by fits and starts down many blind alleys, with much heated debate and correction of errors, has led not only to modern astronomy and astrophysics, but also to nothing less than the scientific worldview, and, for better and for worse, our contemporary civilization. The findings and perspectives of modern astronomy would not only dazzle those ancients who began our subject, they would, I think, have elicited disbelief. We observe objects so far away that their light set out on its intergalactic voyage before the Earth was formed, and this light reveals that the laws of nature are the same there as here. Our airplanes fly through the upper air collecting microscopic remnants of long-dead comets. Meteorites are identified. This one comes from an asteroid, this one comes from Mars. This little meteoritic grain was formed billions of years ago in the dark between the stars. We bounce radio waves off planets to map volcanic mountains and cratered plains and look for hidden oceans. Radio telescopes in Massachusetts and Argentina, supported by small contributions from 100,000 people all over the Earth, are searching for possible signals from alien intelligences on the planets of other stars. We postulate a connection between mass extinctions of life on Earth and the motions of comets in an invisible cloud far beyond the outermost planet, stirred up by passing stars. From the concentration and motion of stars in distinct galaxies, the presence of invisible and massive black holes is deduced. Radio waves filling all of space are interpreted as the remnant of an immense explosion which initiated the present incarnation of the universe. That cosmic background radiation is so uniform in all directions as to challenge astronomers who are finding that the matter in the universe, on the largest scales we can see, is arranged into great non-uniform bubble-like structures. The universe seems destined to expand forever. Unless, some astronomers say, the universe is mainly composed of a kind of matter that does not exist on Earth. We are beginning to understand the lives and deaths of worlds, stars, galaxies, and perhaps the universe itself. The entire electromagnetic spectrum, from short gamma rays to long radio waves, is being examined to see what information the universe is sending us. We have peppered the tops of the Earth's mountains with optical and infrared telescopes, have covered over valleys with wire to make immense radio telescopes, and have observed the neutrinos from an exploding star in a satellite galaxy of the Milky Way from observatories in mines far beneath the surface of the Earth. We have carried telescopes in airplanes, balloons, and Earth satellites above the obscuring atmosphere of the Earth. We have sent robotic ships to dozens of previously unknown worlds. We have landed on the moon and two planets and brought back lunar samples. As I write, there is a spacecraft in orbit around Venus, mapping the surface hidden beneath its opaque clouds. Another, having encountered Halley's comet, is journeying to another comet. Two others are on their way to peer down at the poles of the sun and to drop an entry probe into the atmosphere of the giant planet Jupiter. And four artifacts of the human species are beyond the orbit of Pluto, seeking the boundary between the solar system and the interstellar medium, inexorably on their way to the realm of the stars. This is an age of ferment in astronomy. Many old paradigms are being shaken. New insights into the intricacy and elegance of the cosmos are being uncovered. These are signs of tempestuous adolescence in a subject rapidly maturing. Since astronomy does not, in the short run, put bread on the average person's table, it might seem surprising that it has been supported at so high a level. But astronomy excites our sense of wonder, answers many of the deepest questions that humans have ever asked, inspires young people to pursue science, and provides a useful antidote for the anthropocentric conceit. It would be cost-effective at twice the price. Life in the Universe. My job is to describe the possibility of life elsewhere. This is, in a way, a new problem, a new question, because for most of human history there was no elsewhere. This was the only world. There wasn't any other world. There wasn't any other place for life like us. And so the issue never arose. Yes, there were gods or demons who come from the sky. Demons from the interior of the earth is a very new idea. It used to be that the demons lived up in the sky, too. Also, when we thought that the world was only a few thousand years old, the idea of evolution was silly, because if one species had evolved from another over a few thousand years, you should be able to see it happening. I mean, just watch this dog and see it turn into a cat. Doesn't happen? Forget about evolution. It's a ridiculous idea. But now that we know that the world is 4.5 billion years old, extremely slow changes in heredity can build up to enormous differences from organism to organism, and evolution has to be taken seriously. And this idea, and the grander idea that life on Earth arose by chemical processes about 4 billion years ago, which, while certainly not absolutely confirmed, is certainly the prevailing view, and there's much to support it, indicates that the laws of nature permit order to be extracted from chaos without divine intervention. The divine intervention, if you like, is in the establishment of the laws of nature that permit these processes in the first place. But the idea of a micro-interventionist deity who has to fix things, in a way, is an impious idea. If a deity is omnipotent and omniscient, why does she or he have to fix things? Why not get it right in the first place? This meddling is a sign of incompetence. And it's a much grander idea, I believe, to imagine a deity, if you want, who gets it right in the first place, establishes the laws of nature in the physical cosmos, lets it roll, and then goes and does something else, maybe with those infinite number of other universes that she or he may have to deal with. If we look at life on Earth, we find astonishing similarities. For example, we and the chimpanzees share 99.6% of our active genes, which means either that 0.4% is a larger number than we had hitherto understood, or that we have a lot to learn about ourselves from studying those guys. And the apparent gross differences between us and oak trees, slime molds, killer whales, viruses, I mean, that's a big range, right? But yet you look closely and you find that all of those beings, all the beings on Earth, use nucleic acids to encode the heredity material. It's the language of life. They all use amino acids, the building blocks of proteins, as the catalysts that control the chemistry going on inside and in the vicinity of the organism, and use essentially the same code book to translate nucleic acid information into protein information. How could those impressive, formidable, awesome similarities occur unless all life on Earth has evolved from a single common ancestor? If that is true, and that is certainly the prevailing understanding, then we know almost nothing about life because we have only one example of it. All the differences are superficial. Down deep, there's only one kind of life on Earth. If there's life elsewhere, does it have nucleic acids? Does it have proteins? Does it have the same code book? Never mind if they look ugly. What are they based on? How do they work? Where did they come from? We don't know. And do they have to be based on carbon or water as we are? I confess to you, I am personally a carbon and a water chauvinist. But that may be an accident of birth or a failure of the imagination. I can give you arguments why everybody else has to be based on the same molecules as me, but it's a suspect argument because I have a vested interest. Now, something happened to our ancestors who studied the stars. They saw as an everyday occurrence the sun, the moon, the planets, and the stars rising in the east and setting in the west. And then somehow, tomorrow, they went under the Earth, and there they are, ready to come up again. That seems to mean we are at the center of the universe. It's as clear as anything. We're at the center. What's more, we use the stars for calendrical and other purposes. Nobody else, none of those slime molds or oak trees, did. The stars clearly were made for us. The universe was made for us. Every human culture bought into this delusion. It wasn't until the 15th century that we slowly began extricating ourselves from it. We still have trouble doing that. Think about how poetic and reasonable the words sunrise and sunset are. But of course, that's a pre-Copernican phrasing. The sun is not rising and setting, the earth is turning. Think of how hard it is to parse heliocentrism into ordinary English. You know, something like, Billy, be sure to be home before the rotation of the earth makes the local horizon occult the sun. Billy's long gone before you're done. The language doesn't permit us to utilize the Copernican perspective. And by the way, something approaching half of American adults do not know that the earth goes around the sun and takes a year to do it. Speaking about the more difficult problems in education. Now, I would like just to give a quick visual perspective on the idea that we are at the center of the universe. There is a recent Hubble Space Telescope photograph of an obscure edge of the Virgo cluster, some 45 million light-years away. This is a giant elliptical galaxy in the Virgo cluster. But almost everything else you see, all these other things, are not stars in our galaxy and not galaxies in the Virgo cluster, but galaxies behind the Virgo cluster. And there are some 100 billion other galaxies in the known universe. Now, suppose you were an intergalactic traveler seeking interesting galaxies, and you were told that the beings who are the point of the universe live on one of those galaxies. See that little one right there? That's the center of the universe. And they are the reason the whole universe of 100 billion galaxies was made. Just ask them. What's your sense of them? Now you pick out one of these galaxies, the Milky Way galaxy, as seen from the outside. You're seeing a few hot stars and regions illuminated by hot stars. Some clusters, but no stars like the Sun. Suppose you were told that right there, according to the beings who live there, is the center of the universe. The fourth spiral arm out in the galactic boondocks where it's not even well lit. That's the center of the universe. You might think that these guys are on the planet of the idiots. And now suppose you plunged into that part of the galaxy. There are 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy alone, and the beings for whom the universe was made live here. It's a pathetic conceit, which we should not castigate our ancestors for, because they had only their everyday common sense notion about stars rising and setting, and their aspirations to be important through no effort of their own. We today are in a very different position. For us to think that we are the point of the universe today is, I believe, truly reprehensible. There is a very nice U.S. Geological Survey montage of some of the results of NASA's heroic 3 decades of planetary exploration and discovery. Some worlds are shown thrice, 3 different central meridian longitudes. The solar system, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, a range of the moons of the Jovian planets, 1 comet, and if this were done lately, there would be 3 asteroids added that have been examined close up. There is a gorgeous, beautiful array of worlds in the solar system. We live on 1 quite minor world. There are 4 big ones. Isaac Asimov described an extraterrestrial observer entering the solar system and describing it as 4 planets plus debris. We live on 1 of the hunks of debris. How did life arise on our planet, and is there any elsewhere? I should confess straight out that nobody knows the answer, certainly, to the latter question. And to the former, we have some very interesting hints. I will in a moment describe some of them, but we don't really know that either. What we do know is that there are circumstances in which the very molecules that we are made of, the building blocks of the proteins, the building blocks of the nucleic acids, spontaneously form, and that is surely a hint that making us was not that difficult. Moreover, the Earth was uninhabitable because of impacts until something like 4 billion years ago. By 3.6 billion years ago, the Earth had abundant microbial life. And from the fossil forms, we can tell that those could not have been the first life. It was too complex. Therefore, the origin of life had a very narrow window available for it, maybe something like 100 million years. That means, I think, that it was a probable event, and I'll come back to that in a second on Mars. The outer solar system, all these worlds, are loaded with organic matter, the carbon-based stuff that all life on Earth is made of. In the interest of time, I want to concentrate on one such world. There is a moon of Saturn called Titan. It's the biggest moon in the Saturn system, 2nd biggest moon in the solar system, an absolutely extraordinary world relevant to our question, covered with a kind of orange smog, haze layers above the planet. Voyager 1 was in part dedicated to trying to take high-resolution photographs to see breaks in the haze and cloud. Could we see the underlying surface? We could not. The idea of a moon with an atmosphere, clearly this has an atmosphere, a moon with red clouds, that's sort of weird. What is happening there? What is that stuff? But as Voyager 1 and 2 discovered, the surface temperature is about 95 degrees above absolute zero, far below the freezing point of water. This is a very cold world. The surface pressure, however, is high. There's about 10 times as much air above a square centimeter of surface on Titan than on Earth. And that air, as on Earth, is made mainly of nitrogen. The second constituent is methane, CH4. Voyager discovered about 8 simple organic molecules in the gas phase, already telling us that there is organic chemistry going on today in the upper atmosphere of this planet. There are sources of energy pouring into the Titan atmosphere, each of which reaches a certain depth, including electrons from the magnetosphere of Saturn through which Titan plows, ultraviolet light from the Sun, cosmic rays, and other sources. We think we have bottled the haze of Titan. Since we have it in our laboratory, we can analyze it to see what it is. Without asking you to spend any time on the details, it is loaded with amino acids to the tune of 1% of it, and there's an enormous range of other organic molecules. Chemists will recognize some of the purine and pyrimidine bases of nucleic acids. So here we have this extremely curious circumstance that an obscure world in the outer solar system, minding its own business, being irradiated by charged particles from nearby Saturn and light from the Sun, is producing organic molecules which are raining down like manna from heaven. We can calculate, if the same process had been going on for the last 4 billion years, the amount of stuff accumulated on the surface ought to be tens, maybe hundreds of meters thick. That's an awful lot of stuff. It would be great to analyze it directly. The NASA and European Space Agency joint mission called Cassini is designed to arrive in 2004. An entry probe is to enter through the haze and examine what's happening there. Of course, nobody knows what the surface of Titan actually looks like. In fact, you would not see Saturn from the surface of Titan unless you had infrared eyes. The artist may be imagining what it looks like in the infrared, and we will have in situ organic chemistry done then. The one thing about Titan that doesn't match the Earth with regard to simulating early conditions on Earth is, of course, liquid water. It's too cold there. Except that it turns out, when there is a hypervelocity impact by a comet, it liquefies, it makes a kind of slurry of the snows on the surface, and it takes a long time to refreeze. It looks as if about half the surface of Titan, over geological time, has seen liquid water for something like 1,000 years. Whether all of that organic matter in liquid water for 1,000 years has taken us far beyond the chemistry I just described to you is an interesting open question for which we should hold our breath until 2004. The one other world I want to briefly mention with regard to life is Mars. It's a world of wonders. It is the place that the Viking spacecraft, a glory of the U.S. space program, landed in 1976. There were experiments to dig in the Martian soil. Look, we're doing civil engineering in other worlds. Extract soil samples back into the spacecraft and look for microbes. No microbes were found in two places 5,000 kilometers apart by a variety of sensitive instruments. Funny results were obtained, not fully understood. The bulk of the scientific opinion is, whatever it is, it's not life. But now, at the same time, where the spacecraft taketh away, they also giveth, there is extraordinary evidence that Mars, which today has no liquid water, too cold, atmospheric pressure too low, once had abundant running water. There were also lakes and conceivably some, this is disputed, oceans. When was that? That was about 4 billion years ago. That is, at the very moment when the origin of life was happening on the Earth, Martian conditions were extremely Earth-like. Is it possible that life arose on one of those worlds and not the other? Or did life arise on both, and then deteriorating climatic conditions on Mars made that life go underground or become extinct, and on Earth to survive and prosper? We don't know the answer, but Mars is clearly a very important place to explore. We now have increasing evidence that there are planets of other stars. This is an accretion disk surrounding a nearby star called Beta Pictoris. This is just the sort of thing that has been hypothesized for the early history of the solar system as the Sun was forming, the planets condensing, accreting out of a circumstellar disk of gas and dust. There is a Hubble Space Telescope picture in the Orion Nebula of, in fact, dozens of very young stars in which that's happening. The system of the pulsar 1257 plus 12 has at least 3 planets of recognizable similarity to Earth, both in mass and in distance from the star, suggesting that there are enormous numbers of planets throughout the Milky Way galaxy and that we are on the verge of being able to detect them. And that, of course, means there are lots of potential abodes for life. I want to conclude with just a word or two about my favorite planet in this entire glorious universe. This universe of 100 billion galaxies, each with maybe 100 billion stars, and that is ours. It's again a chauvinism to which I freely confess. I like the Earth, in part because I am beautifully adapted to it and to no other world. I appreciate it. Of course, this is a confusion of cause and effect. Nevertheless, it's something deeply felt. When the two Voyager spacecraft were beyond Neptune, it was possible to turn the cameras of one of them back to look at the planets that we had long passed. And of course, you would not see any detail. There would be a single pixel, a single picture element, but I thought it might be useful to get that, not for scientific reasons, but for other reasons. We turned the camera back and were able to photograph from beyond the outermost planet 6 of the 9 planets of our solar system. And there, momentarily in a sunbeam, is the Earth, a pale blue dot. The abundance of life-bearing planets. We live in an age of remarkable exploration and discovery. Fully half of the nearby sun-like stars have circumstellar disks of gas and dust, like the solar nebula out of which our planets formed 4.6 billion years ago. By a most unexpected technique, radio timing residual, we have discovered 2 Earth-like planets around the pulsar B1257+12. An apparent Jovian planet has been astrometrically detected around the star 51 Pegasi. A range of new Earth-based and space-borne techniques, including astrometry, spectrophotometry, radial velocity measurements, adaptive optics, and interferometry, all seem to be on the verge of being able to detect Jovian-style planets, if they exist, around the nearest stars. At least one proposal, the Frequency of Earth-Sized Inner Planets Project, a space-borne spectrophotometric system, holds the promise of detecting terrestrial planets more readily than Jovian ones. If there is not a sudden cutoff in support, we are likely entering a golden age in the study of the planets of other stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Once you have found another planet of Earth-like mass, however, it of course does not follow that it is an Earth-like world. Consider Venus. But there are means by which, even from the vantage point of Earth, we can investigate this question. We can look for the spectral signature of enough water to be consistent with oceans. We can look for oxygen in the planet's atmosphere. We can seek molecules like methane in such wild thermodynamic disequilibrium with the oxygen that it can only be produced by life. In fact, all of these tests for life were successfully performed by the Galileo spacecraft in its close approaches to Earth in 1990 and 1992 as it wended its way to Jupiter. The best current estimates of the number and spacing of Earth-mass planets in newly forming planetary systems, combined with the best current estimates of the long-term stability of oceans on a variety of planets, suggest 1 to 2 blue worlds around every sun-like star. Stars much more massive than the Sun are comparatively rare and age quickly. Stars comparatively less massive than the Sun are expected to have Earth-like planets, but the planets that are warm enough for life are probably tidally locked so that one side always faces the local Sun. However, winds may redistribute heat from one hemisphere to another on such worlds, and there has been very little work on their potential habitability. Nevertheless, the bulk of the current evidence suggests a vast number of planets distributed through the Milky Way with abundant liquid water stable over lifetimes of billions of years. Some will be suitable for life, our kind of carbon and water life, for billions of years less than Earth, some for billions of years more. And of course, the Milky Way is one of an enormous number, perhaps 100 billion other galaxies. We know from lunar cratering statistics, calibrated by returned Apollo samples, that Earth was under hellish bombardment by small and large worlds from space until around 4 billion years ago. This pummeling was sufficiently severe to drive entire atmospheres and oceans into space. Earlier, the entire crust of Earth was a magma ocean. Clearly, this was no breeding ground for life. Yet shortly thereafter, some early organisms arose, according to the fossil evidence. Presumably, the origin of life had to have occupied some time before that. As soon as conditions were favorable, life began amazingly fast on our planet. I have used this fact to argue that the origin of life must be a highly probable circumstance. As soon as conditions permit, up it pops. Now, I recognize that this is at best a plausibility argument and little more than an extrapolation from a single example. But we are data constrained. It's the best we can do. Does a similar analysis apply to the evolution of intelligence? Here you have a planet burgeoning with life, profoundly changing the physical environment, generating an oxygen atmosphere 2 billion years ago, going through elegant diversification, and not for almost 4 billion years does anything remotely resembling a technical civilization emerge. In the early days of such debates, writers argued that an enormous number of individually unlikely steps were required to produce something very like a human being, a humanoid, that the chances of such a precise repetition occurring on another planet were nil, and therefore that the chance of extraterrestrial intelligence was nil. But clearly, when we're talking about extraterrestrial intelligence, we are not talking, despite Star Trek, of humans or humanoids. We are talking about the functional equivalent of humans, say, any creatures able to build and operate radio telescopes. They may live on the land or in the sea or air. They may have unimaginable chemistries, shapes, sizes, colors, appendages, and opinions. We are not requiring that they follow the particular route that led to the evolution of humans. There may be many different evolutionary pathways, each unlikely, but the sum of the number of pathways to intelligence may nevertheless be quite substantial. Evolution is opportunistic and not foresighted. It does not plan to develop intelligent life a few billion years into the future. It responds to short-term contingencies. And yet, other things being equal, it is better to be smart than to be stupid, and an overall trend toward intelligence can be perceived in the fossil record. On some worlds, the selection pressure for intelligence may be higher, on others lower. If we consider the statistics of one, our own case, and take a typical time from the origin of a planetary system to the development of a technical civilization to be 4.6 billion years, what follows? We would not expect civilizations on different worlds to evolve in lockstep. Some would reach technical intelligence more quickly, some more slowly, and doubtless some never. But the Milky Way is filled with second and third generation stars, that is, those with heavy elements, as old as 10 billion years. So, let's imagine two curves. The first is the probable time scale to the evolution of technical intelligence. It starts out very low. By a few billion years, it may have a noticeable value. By 5 billion years, it's something like 50%. By 10 billion years, maybe it's approaching 100%. The second curve is the ages of sun-like stars, some of which are very young, they're being born right now, some of which are as old as the sun, some of which are 10 billion years old. If we convolve these two curves, we find there's a chance of technical civilizations on planets of stars of many different ages. Not much in the very young ones, more and more for the older ones. The most likely case is that we will hear from a civilization considerably more advanced than ours. For each of those technical civilizations, there have been tens of billions or more other species. The number of unlikely events that had to be concatenated to evolve the technical species is enormous. And perhaps there are members of each of those species who pride themselves on being uniquely intelligent in all the universe. It is perfectly possible to imagine civilizations of poets, or perhaps Bronze Age warriors, who never stumble on James Clerk Maxwell's equations and radio receivers. But they are removed by natural selection. The Earth is surrounded by a population of asteroids and comets such that occasionally the planet is struck by one large enough to do substantial damage. The most famous is the KT event, the massive near-Earth object impact that occurred at the end of the Cretaceous period and start of the Tertiary of 65 million years ago that extinguished the dinosaurs and most other species of life on Earth. But the chance is something like 1 in 2,000 that a civilization-destroying impact will occur in the next century. It is already clear that we need elaborate means for detecting and tracking near-Earth objects and the means for their interception and destruction. If we fail to do so, we will simply be destroyed. The Indus Valley, Sumerian, Egyptian, Greek, and other civilizations did not have to face this crisis because they did not live long enough. Any long-lived civilization, terrestrial or extraterrestrial, must come to grips with this hazard. Other solar systems will have greater or lesser asteroidal and cometary fluxes, but in almost all cases the dangers should be substantial. Radio telemetry, radar monitoring of asteroids, and the entire concept of the electromagnetic spectrum is part and parcel of any early technology needed to deal with such a threat. Thus, any long-lived civilization will be forced by natural selection to develop the technology. The notion that we can, by a priori arguments, exclude the possibility of intelligent life on the possible planets of the 400 billion stars in the Milky Way has to my ears an odd ring. It reminds me of the long series of human conceits that held us to be at the center of the universe, or different not just in degree but in kind from the rest of life on Earth, or even contended that the universe was made for our benefit. Beginning with Copernicus, every one of these conceits has been shown to be without merit. In the case of extraterrestrial intelligence, let us admit our ignorance, put aside a priori arguments, and use the technology we are fortunate enough to have developed to try and actually find out the answer. That is, I think, what Charles Darwin, who was converted from orthodox religion to evolutionary biology by the weight of observational evidence, would have advocated. Is there intelligent life on Earth? You're an alien explorer entering the solar system after a long journey through the blackness of interstellar space. You examine the planets of this humdrum star from afar. A pretty handful, some gray, some blue, some red, some yellow. You're interested in what kinds of worlds these are, whether their environments are changing, and especially whether there is life and intelligence. You have no prior knowledge of the Earth. You have just discovered its existence. Let's imagine there's a galactic ethic, look but don't touch. You can fly by these worlds, you can orbit them, but you are strictly forbidden to land. Under such circumstances, could you figure out what the Earth's environment is like and whether anyone lives there? Your first impression on seeing a picture of the whole Earth is white clouds, white polar caps, brownish continents, and some bluish substance that covers two-thirds of the surface. You cannot know beforehand the composition of any of these. When you measure the temperature of this world from the infrared radiation it emits, you find that most latitudes are above the freezing point of water, while the polar caps are below the freezing point. Water is a very abundant material in the cosmos, so a reasonable guess would be polar caps made of solid water, as well as clouds of solid and liquid water. You might also be tempted to conclude that the blue stuff is vast quantities, kilometers deep, of liquid water. But your last suggestion is bizarre, at least as far as this solar system is concerned, because surface oceans of liquid water exist on none of the other worlds. However, when you look in the visible and near-infrared spectrum for telltale signatures of chemical composition, sure enough, you find sufficient water vapor in the air to account for the clouds, and just the amount that must exist because of evaporation if the oceans are in fact made of liquid water. The spectrometers also reveal that the air on this world is almost one-fifth oxygen. No other planet in the solar system has anything close to so much oxygen. Where does it come from? The intense ultraviolet light from the sun breaks down water in the high atmosphere into oxygen and hydrogen quickly escapes to space. This is a source of oxygen, certainly, but it doesn't easily account for so much oxygen. Another possibility is that ordinary visible light, of which the sun puts out so much, is used to break water apart, except that there's no known way to do this without life. there would have to be plants. Life forms, colored by a pigment that strongly absorbs visible light and that knows how to split water, spread over much of the planet. If you're a good skeptical scientist, the oxygen would not be proof of life, but rather the merest hint of life. With all that oxygen, you're not surprised to discover ozone in the atmosphere, because ultraviolet light makes ozone out of oxygen. The ozone then absorbs dangerous ultraviolet radiation. So, if the oxygen is due to life, there's a curious sense in which the life is protecting itself. But this life might be photosynthetic plants. A high level of intelligence is not implied. When you examine the continents more closely, you find there are, crudely speaking, two kinds of regions. One shows the spectrum of ordinary sorts of rocks and minerals found on many worlds. The other reveals something unusual, a material covering vast area that strongly absorbs red light. The sun shines in light of all colors with a peak in the yellow. This pigment is just the sort of thing needed if ordinary visible light is being used to break water apart and account for the oxygen in the air. It's another hint, this time a little stronger, of life. Not a bug here and there, but a planetary surface chock full of life. This pigment is, in fact, chlorophyll. It absorbs blue light from the sun as well as red and is responsible for the fact that plants are green. What you're seeing is a densely vegetated planet. When you look carefully at the infrared spectrum of the Earth, you find many minor constituents of the air. In addition to water, there's carbon dioxide, methane, and other gases, which absorb the heat that the Earth tries to radiate away to space at night. These gases warm the planet. Without them, the Earth would everywhere be below the freezing point of water. You have discovered this world's greenhouse effect. There's something odd about having methane and oxygen together in the same atmosphere. The laws of chemistry are very clear. When there is an excess of oxygen, methane should be entirely converted into water and carbon dioxide. The process is so efficient that not a single molecule in all the Earth's atmosphere should be methane. But in fact, you find that one out of every million molecules is methane. An immense discrepancy. What could it mean? The only possible explanation is that methane is being injected into the Earth's atmosphere so quickly that its chemical reaction with oxygen can't keep pace. What might be the source of this methane? Maybe it seeps out of the deep interior of the Earth. But Venus and Mars don't have anything like this much methane. The only alternatives are biological. This conclusion makes no assumptions about the chemistry of life on this planet, but merely follows from how unstable methane is in an oxygen atmosphere. In fact, the methane arises from such sources as bacteria in bogs, the cultivation of rice, the burning of vegetation, natural gas from oil wells, and, I'm trying to put this decorously, bovine flatulence. In an oxygen atmosphere, methane is a sign of life. It's a little disquieting that the intimate intestinal activities of cows should be detectable from interplanetary space, when, as we will see, so much of what we consider important and hold dear is not. As an alien scientist flying by the Earth, you would not be able at this point to deduce cows, but you would almost certainly deduce life. All the signs of life that we've discussed so far are due to comparatively simple forms. Had your spacecraft flown by the Earth 100 million years ago, in the age of the dinosaurs, when there were no humans and no technology, you would still have seen oxygen and ozone, the chlorophyll pigment, and far too much methane. But now your instruments also are finding signs not just of life, but of high technology, something that couldn't possibly have been detected 100 million years ago. You are detecting radio transmission from the Earth. At just the frequencies where radio waves begin to leak out of the Earth's ionosphere, which reflects and absorbs radio waves. The signal is modulated, a sequence of ons and offs. Your conclusion that the radio transmission is due to technology on Earth holds no matter what the ons and offs mean. You don't have to decode the message to be sure it is a message. In fact, the signal is a communications relay from the U.S. Navy to its distant nuclear submarines. So, as an alien explorer, you would know that at least one of the species of beings on Earth has achieved radio technology. Which ones? The ones that make methane? The ones that make oxygen? The ones whose pigment colors the landscape green? Or somebody else, somebody more subtle, somebody not so readily apparent to a flyby spacecraft? To search for this technological species, you might want to examine the Earth in finer and finer detail, seeking, if not the beings themselves, at least their artifacts. You look first with modest telescopes, so the finest detail you can make out is about 1 or 2 kilometers across. At this level of detail, you can make out no strange formations, no obvious signs of life. You observe a dense atmosphere in motion. The abundant water must evaporate and then rain back down on the ground. The ancient impact craters, apparent on the Earth's nearby moon, are almost wholly absent. There must then be a set of processes whereby new land is created and then eroded away in much less time than the age of this world. Running water is implicated. As you look with finer and finer definition, you find mountain ranges, river valleys, and many other indications that this planet is geologically active. There are odd places surrounded by vegetation, but which are themselves denuded of plants. They look like discolored smudges on the landscape. Many of them are, in fact, large cities, but you'd never be able to prove it unless you looked in finer detail. When you examine the Earth at about 100-meter resolution, everything changes. The planet is revealed to be covered with straight lines, squares, rectangles, circles, of a regularity and complexity that would be hard to explain except by life and intelligence. You would not know what all this was about. Perhaps you would conclude only that the dominant life forms on the planet have a simultaneous passion for territoriality and Euclidean geometry. At this resolution, you would not be able to see them, much less know them. When you take pictures at a few meters resolution, you find that the crisscrossing straight lines of the cities and the long straight lines that connect the cities seem to be filled with streamlined, multicolored beings a few meters in length, politely running one behind the other. At night, they turn on 2 bright lights in front so they can see where they're going. The streets of the cities and the roadways of the countryside are clearly built for their benefit. Some of them, when their workday is done, go to little houses to retire for the night. At last you have detected the source of all the technology, the dominant life form on the planet. You might begin to believe that you were really beginning to understand life on Earth, and perhaps you'd be right. If the resolution improved just a little further, you would discover tiny parasites that occasionally enter and exit the dominant organisms. Something most interesting is revealed when you photograph the Earth at night. The planet is lit up. The brightest region near the Arctic Circle is lit by the Aurora Borealis, generated not by life, but by electrons and protons from the sun. Everything else you see is due to life. The lights outline the same continents that you can make out in daytime, and many correspond to the cities that you've already mapped. The cities are concentrated near the coastlines. They tend to be sparser in the continental interiors. Perhaps the dominant organisms are desperate for seawater, or maybe ocean-going ships were once essential for trade and emigration. Some of the lights, though, are not due to cities. In North Africa and the Middle East, for example, there are very bright lights in the desert. They are due to the burn-off of oil and natural gas wells. In the Sea of Japan, there is a strange triangular area of light. In daylight, it corresponds to open ocean. This is no city. What could it be? It is, in fact, the Japanese squid fishing fleet, using brilliant illumination to attract schools of squid to their deaths. This pattern of light wanders all over the Pacific Ocean, seeking its prey. In effect, what we have discovered here is sushi. It is sobering that you can readily detect some of the odds and ends of life on Earth, the gastrointestinal habits of ruminants, Japanese cuisine, the means of communicating with nomadic submarines that carried death for 200 cities, while so much of our art, literature, science, and compassion are almost wholly invisible. It's a kind of parable for our time. By this point, your expedition to the Earth must be considered highly successful. You've characterized the environment, you've detected life, you've found manifestations of intelligent beings. Surely this planet is worth a longer and more detailed study. That's why you've now inserted your spacecraft into orbit around the Earth. Looking down on the planet, you uncover new puzzles. All over the planet, smokestacks are putting carbon dioxide and toxic chemicals into the air. So are the beings who run on the roadways. But carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. As you watch, the amount of it in the atmosphere increases steadily, year after year. The same is true of methane and other greenhouse gases. If this keeps up, the temperature of the planet is going to increase steeply. Another class of molecules being injected into the air is the chlorofluorocarbons. Not only are they greenhouse gases, but they also are very efficient in destroying the protective ozone layer. You look more closely at the center of the South American continent, which, as you know by now, is a vast rainforest. Every night you see thousands of fires. In the daytime you find the region covered with smoke. Over the years, all over the planet, you find less and less forest and more scrub desert. You look down on the large island of Madagascar. The rivers are colored brown, generating a vast stain in the surrounding ocean. This is topsoil being washed out to sea at a rate so high that in another few decades there will be none left. And the same thing is happening, you note, in many other places. From your orbital perspective, you can see that something has unmistakably gone wrong. The dominant organisms, whoever they are, who have gone to so much trouble to rework the surface, are simultaneously destroying their ozone layer and their forests, eroding their topsoil and performing massive, uncontrolled experiments on their planet's climate. Haven't they noticed what's happening? Are they oblivious to their fate? Are they unable to work together on behalf of the environment that sustains all of them? Perhaps, you think, it's time to reassess the hypothesis that there is intelligent life on Earth. The search for extraterrestrial life. In the past few decades, the human species has begun, seriously and systematically, to look for evidence of life elsewhere. While no one has yet found living organisms beyond the Earth, there are some reasons to be encouraged. Robotic space probes have identified worlds where life may once have gained a toehold, even if it does not flourish there today. The Galileo spacecraft found clear signs of life during its recent flight past the Earth, a reassurance that we really do know how to sniff out at least certain kinds of life. And rapidly accumulating evidence strongly suggests that the universe abounds with planetary systems something like our own. In practice, the community of scientists concerned with finding life elsewhere in the solar system has contented itself with a chemical approach. Human beings, as well as every other organism on the Earth, are based on liquid water and organic molecules. Organic molecules are carbon-containing compounds other than carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. A modest search strategy, looking for necessary if not sufficient criteria, might then begin by looking for liquid water and organic molecules. Of course, such a protocol might miss forms of life about which we are wholly ignorant, but that does not mean we could not detect them by other methods. If a silicon-based giraffe had walked by the Viking Mars landers, its portrait would have been taken. Actually, focusing on organic matter and liquid water is not nearly so parochial and chauvinistic as it might seem. No other chemical element comes close to carbon in the variety and intricacy of the compounds it can form. Liquid water provides a superb, stable medium in which organic molecules can dissolve and interact. What is more, organic molecules are surprisingly common in the universe. Astronomers find evidence for them everywhere, from interstellar gas and dust grains to meteorites to many worlds in the outer solar system. Some other molecules, hydrogen fluoride, for example, might approach water in their ability to dissolve other molecules, but the cosmic abundance of fluorine is extremely low. Certain atoms, such as silicon, might be able to take on some of the roles of carbon in an alternative life chemistry, but the variety of information-bearing molecules they provide seems comparatively sparse. Furthermore, the silicon equivalent of carbon dioxide, silicon dioxide, the major component of ordinary glass, is, on all planetary surfaces, a solid, not a gas. That distinction would certainly complicate the development of a silicon-based metabolism. On extremely cold worlds, where water is frozen solid, some other solvent, liquid ammonia, for instance, might be a key to a different form of biochemistry. At low temperatures, certain classes of molecules require very little activation energy to undergo chemical reactions, but because our laboratories are at room temperature and not, say, at the temperature of Neptune's satellite Triton, our knowledge of those molecules may well be inadequate. For the moment, though, carbon and water-based life forms are the only kinds we know or can even imagine. On the Earth, the signature molecules of life are the nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, which constitute the hereditary instructions, and the proteins, which, as enzymes, catalytically control the chemistry of cell and organism. The code book for translating nucleic acid information into protein structure is essentially identical for all life on Earth. This profound uniformity in the hereditary chemistry suggests that every organism on our planet has evolved from a common instance of the origin of life. If so, we have no way of knowing which aspects of terrestrial life are necessary, required of all living things anywhere, and which are merely contingent, the results of a particular sequence of happenstances that, had they gone otherwise, might have led to organisms having very different properties. We may speculate, but only by examining life elsewhere can biologists truly determine what else is possible. The obvious place to start the search for life is in our own solar system. Robot spacecraft have explored more than 70 planets, satellites, comets, and asteroids at distances varying from about 100 to about 100,000 kilometers. These ships have been equipped with magnetometers, charged particle detectors, imaging systems, and photometric and spectrometric instruments that sense radiation ranging from ultraviolet to kilometer wavelength radio. For the Moon, Venus, and Mars, observations from orbiters and landers have confirmed and expanded on findings transmitted back from flyby spacecraft. None of these encounters has yielded compelling or even strongly suggestive indications of extraterrestrial life. Still, such life, if it exists, might be quite unlike the forms with which we are familiar, or it might be present only marginally. Or the remote sensing techniques used for examining other worlds might be insensitive to the conceivably subtle signs of life on another world. The most elementary test of these techniques, the detection of life on the Earth by an instrumented flyby spacecraft, had until recently never been attempted. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration's Galileo has rectified that omission. Galileo is a dual-purpose spacecraft that incorporates a Jupiter orbiter and entry probe. For technical reasons, NASA was unable to send Galileo on a direct course to Jupiter. Instead, the mission incorporated three gravitational assists, two from the Earth and one from Venus, to send it on its journey. This looping course greatly lengthened the transit time, but it also permitted the spacecraft to make close-up observations of our planet. Galileo's instruments were not designed for an Earth encounter mission, so circumstance fortuitously arranged a control experiment, a search for life on the Earth using a typical modern planetary probe. The results of Galileo's December 1990 encounter with the Earth proved quite enlightening. An observer looking at the data from Galileo would immediately notice some unusual facts about the Earth. When my co-workers and I examined spectra taken by Galileo at near-infrared wavelengths, just slightly longer than red light, we noticed a strong dip in brightness at 0.76 micron, a wavelength at which molecular oxygen absorbs radiation. The prominence of the absorption feature implies an enormous abundance of molecular oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere, many orders of magnitude greater than is found on any other planet in the solar system. Oxygen slowly combines with the rocks on the Earth's surface, so the oxygen-rich atmosphere requires a replenishing mechanism. Some oxygen is freed when ultraviolet light from the sun splits apart molecules of water, H2O, and the low-mass hydrogen atoms preferentially escape into space. But the great concentration of oxygen, 20%, in the Earth's dense atmosphere, is very hard to explain by this process. If visible light, rather than ultraviolet, could split water molecules, the abundance of oxygen could be understood, because the sun emits many more photons of visible light than of ultraviolet. But photons of visible light are too feeble to sever the HOH bond in water. If there were a way to combine two visible light photons to break apart the water molecule, then everything would have a ready solution. Yet so far as we know, there is no way to accomplish this feat except through life, specifically through photosynthesis in plants. The prevalence of molecular oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere is our first clue that the planet bears life. When Galileo photographed the Earth, it found unmistakable evidence of a sharp absorption band painting the continents. Some substance was soaking up radiation at wavelengths around 0.7 micron, the far red end of the visible spectrum. No known minerals show such a feature, and it is found nowhere else in the solar system. The mystery substance is in fact just the kind of light-absorbing pigment we would expect if visible photons were being added together to break down water and generate molecular oxygen. Galileo detected this pigment, which we know as chlorophyll, covering most of the land area of the Earth. Plants appear green precisely because chlorophyll reflects green light but traps the red and blue. The prevalence of the chlorophyll red band offers a second reason to think that the Earth is an inhabited planet. Galileo's infrared spectrometer also detected a trace amount, about one part per million, of methane. Although that might seem insignificant, it is in startling disequilibrium with all that oxygen. In the Earth's atmosphere, methane rapidly oxidizes into water and carbon dioxide. At thermodynamic equilibrium, calculations indicate that not a single molecule of methane should remain. Some unusual processes, which we know to include bacterial metabolism in bogs, rumina, and termites, must steadily refresh the methane supply. The profound methane disequilibrium is a third sign of life on the Earth. Finally, Galileo's plasma wave instrument picked up narrowband, pulsed, amplitude-modulated radio emissions coming from the Earth. These signals begin at the frequency at which radio transmissions on the Earth's surface are first able to leak through the ionosphere. They look nothing like natural sources of radio waves, such as lightning and the Earth's magnetosphere. Such unusual, orderly radio signals strongly suggest the presence of a technological civilization. This is a fourth sign of life, and the only one that would not have been apparent to a similar spacecraft flying by the Earth any time within the past 2 billion years. The Galileo mission served as a significant control experiment of the ability of remote sensing spacecraft to detect life at various stages of evolutionary development on other worlds in the solar system. These positive results encourage us that we would be able to spot the telltale signature of life on other worlds. Given that we have found no such evidence, we tentatively conclude that widespread biological activity now exists among all the bodies of the solar system only on the Earth. Mars is the nearest planet whose surface we can see. It has an atmosphere, polar ice caps, seasonal changes, and a 24-hour day. To generations of scientists, writers, and the public at large, Mars seemed the world most likely to sustain extraterrestrial life. But flybys past and orbiters around Mars have found no excess of molecular oxygen, no substances, whatever their nature, enigmatically and profoundly departing from thermodynamic equilibrium, no unexpected surface pigments, and no modulated radio emissions. In 1976, NASA set down two Viking landers on Mars. I was an experimenter on that mission. The landers were equipped with instruments sensitive enough to detect life, even in unpromising deserts and wastelands on the Earth. One experiment measured the gases exchanged between Martian surface samples and the local atmosphere in the presence of organic nutrients carried from the Earth. A second experiment brought a wide variety of organic foodstuffs marked by a radioactive tracer to see if there were life forms in the Martian soil that ate the food and oxidized it, giving off radioactive carbon dioxide. A third experiment exposed the Martian soil to radioactive carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide to determine if any of it was taken up by microbes. To the initial astonishment of, I think, all the scientists involved, each of the three Viking experiments gave what at first seemed to be positive results. Gases were exchanged, organic matter was oxidized, carbon dioxide was incorporated into the soil. But there are reasons that these provocative results are not generally thought to provide a convincing argument for life on Mars. The putative metabolic processes of Martian microbes occurred under a wide range of conditions: wet and dry, light and dark, cold, only a little above freezing, and hot, almost the normal boiling point of water. Many microbiologists deem it unlikely that Martian microbes would be so capable under such varied conditions. Another strong reason for skepticism is that an additional experiment to look for organic molecules in the Martian soil gave uniformly negative results, even though the instruments could detect such molecules at a sensitivity of around one part per billion. We expected that any life on Mars, as with life on the Earth, would be an expression of the chemistry of carbon-based molecules. To find no such molecules at all was daunting for the optimists among the exobiologists. The apparent positive results of the life detection experiments on the two Viking landers is now generally attributed to chemicals that oxidize the soil. These chemicals form when solar ultraviolet light irradiates the Martian atmosphere. A handful of Viking scientists still wonder whether extremely tough and resilient organisms might exist, so thinly spread over the Martian soil that their organic chemistry could not be detected, but their metabolic processes could. Those scientists do not deny the presence of ultraviolet-generated oxidants, but they emphasize that nobody has yet been able to explain fully the Viking life detection results on the basis of oxidants alone. A few researchers have made tentative claims of finding organic matter in a class of meteorites, the SNC meteorites, that are thought to be bits of the Martian surface blasted into space during ancient impacts. More likely, the organic material consists of contaminants that entered the meteorite after its arrival on our world. For the moment, it is safe to say that Viking found no compelling case for life on Mars. No unambiguous signatures of life emerged from four very different, extremely sensitive experiments conducted at two sites 5,000 kilometers apart on a planet where fast winds transport fine particles around the globe. The Viking findings suggest that Mars is, today at least, a lifeless planet. Could Mars have supported life in the distant past? The answer depends very much on how quickly life can arise, a topic about which we remain sadly ignorant. Astronomers are quite certain that initially, the Earth was inhospitable to life because of the collisions of planetesimals, the planetary building blocks that accreted together to form the Earth. Early on, the Earth was covered by a deep layer of molten rock. After that magma froze, the occasional arrival of large planetesimals would have boiled the oceans and sterilized the Earth, if life had already arisen. Things did not calm down until about 4 billion years ago. And yet fossils reveal that by 3.6 billion years ago, the Earth abounded with microbial life, including large basketball-sized stromatolites, colonies of microorganisms. These early forms of life seem to have been biochemically very adept. Many were photosynthetic, slowly contributing to the Earth's bizarre oxygen-rich atmosphere. Manfred Schidlowski of the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry in Mainz has studied carbon isotope ratios preserved in ancient rocks. That work provided disputed evidence that life was already flourishing 3.8 billion years ago. The inferred time available for the origin of life on the Earth is thus being squeezed from two directions. According to current knowledge, that amount of time may be as brief as 100 million years. When I first drew attention to this squeeze in 1973, after lunar samples returned by Apollo clarified the chronology of impacts on the Moon, I argued that the rapidity with which life arose on the Earth may imply that it is a likely process. It is dangerous to extrapolate from a single example, but it would be a truly remarkable circumstance if life arose quickly here, while on many other similar worlds, given comparable time, it did not. Between 4 and 3.8 billion years ago, conditions on Mars, too, may have favored the emergence of life. The surface of Mars is covered with evidence of ancient rivers, lakes, and perhaps even oceans more than 100 meters deep. The Mars of 4 billion years ago was much warmer and wetter than it is today. Taken together, these pieces of information suggest, although they hardly prove, that life may have arisen on ancient Mars as it did on the ancient Earth. If so, as Mars evolved from congenial to desolate, life would have held on in the last remaining refugia, perhaps saline lakes or places where the interior heat had melted the permafrost. Most planetary scientists agree that searching for chemical or morphological fossils of ancient life should have a high priority in future Martian exploration. Although it is a long shot, searching for life in contemporary Martian oases might also be a productive endeavor. It is now clear that organic chemistry has run rampant through the solar system and beyond. Mars has two small satellites, Phobos and Deimos, which, because of their dark color, seem to be made of, or at least covered by, organic matter. They are widely thought to be captured asteroids from farther out in the solar system. Indeed, there seems to be a vast population of small worlds covered with organic matter, the so-called C and D-type asteroids in the main asteroid belt between Jupiter and Mars, the nuclei of comets, such as Halley's Comet, and the newly discovered class of asteroids near the outermost planets. In 1986, the European Space Agency's Giotto spacecraft flew directly into the cloud of dust surrounding Halley's Comet, revealing that its nucleus may be made of as much as 25% organic matter. A fairly abundant type of meteorite on the Earth, known as carbonaceous chondrite, is thought to consist of fragments from C-type asteroids in the main belt. Carbonaceous meteorites contain an organic residue rich in aromatic and other hydrocarbons. Scientists have also identified a number of amino acids, the building blocks of the proteins, and nucleotide bases, the rungs of the DNA double helix, which spell out the genetic code. Asteroidal and cometary fragments plunging into the atmosphere of the early Earth carried with them vast stores of organic molecules. Some of these survived the intense heating on entry, and therefore may have made a significant material contribution to the origin of life. Impacts would have delivered similar supplies of organic matter, along with water, to other worlds. Those worlds need not be as richly endowed with liquid water as is the Earth, for critical steps in pre-biological chemistry to occur. The water could be found in ponds, in subsurface reservoirs, as thin films on mineral grains, or as ice melts formed by impacts. One of the most fascinating and instructive worlds illustrating pre-biological organic chemistry is Saturn's giant moon Titan, which is as large as the planet Mercury. Here we can see the synthesis of complex organic molecules happening before our eyes. Titan has an atmosphere 10 times as massive as the Earth's, composed mainly of molecular nitrogen, along with a few percent to 10% methane. When Voyager 2 approached Titan in 1981, it could not see the surface, because this world is entirely socked in by an opaque, reddish-orange haze. The surface temperature is very low, about 94 kelvins, or minus 179 degrees Celsius. If we can judge from its density, much lower than that of solid rock, and from the composition of nearby worlds, Titan should have a great deal of water ice on and near its surface. A few simple organic molecules, hydrocarbons and nitriles, are found to be minor constituents of Titan's atmosphere. Ultraviolet light from the sun, charged particles trapped in Saturn's magnetosphere, and cosmic rays all bombard Titan's atmosphere and initiate chemical reactions there. When W. Reed Thompson of Cornell University and I considered the effects of ultraviolet irradiation and simulated those of auroral electron bombardment, we found the results agree well with the observed abundances of gaseous organic constituents. My colleague Bishun N. Khare and I at Cornell simulated the pressure and composition of the appropriate levels in Titan's atmosphere and irradiated the gases with charged particles. The experiment produced a dark organic solid that we call Titanpholin, from the Greek word for muddy. When we measure the optical constants of Titanpholin, we find that it beautifully matches the optical constants derived from observations of the Titan haze. No other proposed material comes close. Organic molecules continually form in the upper atmosphere of Titan and slowly fall out as new tholins are generated in the upper air. If this process has continued over the past 4 billion years, Titan's surface must be covered by tens, maybe even hundreds of meters of tholin and other organic products. Moreover, Thompson and I have calculated that over the history of the solar system, a typical location on Titan has something like a 50-50 chance of having experienced centuries of liquid water from the heat released by impacts. When we mix Titanpholin with water in the laboratory, we make amino acids. There are also traces of nucleotide bases, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and a wonderful brew of other compounds. If 100 million years is enough for the origin of life on Earth, could 1,000 years be enough for it on Titan? Could life have started on Titan during the centuries following an impact, when lakes of water or water ice slurries briefly formed? The first close-up examination of Titan by a Saturn orbiter and Titan entry probe is scheduled to occur when the Cassini mission reaches the Saturn system in about 2004. When we look beyond our solar system into the gas and grains that populate interstellar space, again we find striking signs of the prevalence of organic chemistry. Astronomers examining microwaves emitted and absorbed by molecules at distinctive frequencies have identified more than 4 dozen simple organic compounds in interstellar space. Hydrocarbons, amines, alcohols, and nitriles, some of them having long straight carbon chains such as HC11N. When a cloud of interstellar dust grains lies between the Earth and some more distant infrared source, it is possible to determine which infrared wavelengths are absorbed by the grains, and hence to learn about their composition. Some of the missing infrared light is widely presumed to have been absorbed by polycyclic aromatics, complex hydrocarbons similar to the compounds found in coal tar. In the part of the infrared spectrum near 3.4 microns, 3 distinct absorption features are seen. The same patterns appear in the spectra of comets, in tholins made from the irradiation of hydrocarbon ices, and in meteoritic organic matter. That infrared fingerprint is probably caused by linked aliphatic groups of carbon and hydrogen, minus CH3 and minus CH2. Yvonne Pendleton and her colleagues at the NASA Ames Research Center find that the best spectral fit seems to be with meteoritic organic matter. The infrared match among comets, asteroids, and interstellar clouds may represent the first direct evidence that asteroids and comets contain organic matter that originated on interstellar grains before gathering together in the infant solar system. But the data are also amenable to an opposite interpretation, that some of the organic matter that formed in the early solar nebula accumulated into asteroids and comets, while some was ejected by the sun into interstellar space. If 100 billion other stars did likewise, they could account for a significant fraction of the organic matter in all the interstellar grains in the galaxy. The prevalence of organic material in the outer solar system, in comets that come from far beyond the outermost planets, and in interstellar gas and grains, strongly suggests that complex organic matter, relevant to the origin of life, is widely spread throughout the Milky Way. Organic molecules on bone-dry interstellar grains, fried by ultraviolet light and cosmic rays, seem an unlikely habitat for the origin of life, however. Life seems to need liquid water, which in turn seems to require planets. Astronomical observations increasingly indicate that planetary systems are common. A surprisingly large number of nearby young stars of roughly solar mass are surrounded by just the kind of disks of gas and dust that scientists going back to Immanuel Kant and Pierre Simon, the Marquis de Laplace, say is needed to explain the origin of the planets in our system. These disks provide a persuasive, though still indirect, indication that there is a multitude of planets, presumably including Earth-like worlds, around other stars. George W. Wetherill of the Carnegie Institution of Washington has developed detailed models for predicting the distribution of the planets that should be formed in such circumstellar disks. Meanwhile, James F. Casting of Pennsylvania State University has calculated the range of distances from their suns at which planets can support liquid water on their surfaces. Taken together, these two lines of inquiry suggest that a typical planetary system should contain one and maybe even two Earth-like planets circling at a distance where liquid water is possible. Recently, Alexander Voschan, also at Pennsylvania State, unambiguously detected Earth-like planets in a place where most astronomers least expected to find them, around a pulsar, the swiftly spinning neutron star remnant from a supernova explosion. Based on variations in the timing of radio emissions from the pulsar B1257+12, Voschan has deduced the presence of three planets, so far called only A, B, and C, orbiting the pulsar. These worlds are closer to their star than the Earth is to ours, and pulsar B1257+12 emits in charged particles several times as much energy as does the Sun in electromagnetic radiation. If all the charged particles intercepted by A, B, and C are transformed into heat, these worlds must almost certainly be too hot for life. But Voschan finds hints of at least one additional planet situated farther from the pulsar. For all we know, this superficially unpromising system, 1,400 light-years from the Earth, may contain a dark but habitable planet. It is not clear whether these planets survived from before the supernova explosion or, more likely, formed afterward from surrounding debris. Either way, their presence suggests that planetary formation is an unexpectedly common and widespread process. Numerous searches for planets in infant and mature sun-like systems are underway. The pace of exploration is becoming so quick, and so many new techniques are about to be employed, that it seems likely that in the next few decades, astronomers will begin accumulating a sizable inventory of planets around nearby stars. We have every reason to believe that there are many water-rich worlds, something like our own, each provided with a generous complement of complex organic molecules. Those planets that circle sun-like stars could offer environments in which life would have billions of years to arise and evolve. Should not there be an immense number and diversity of inhabited worlds in the Milky Way? Scientists differ about the strength of this argument, but even at its best, it is very different from actually detecting life elsewhere. That monumental discovery remains to be made. The search for signals from space. As children, we fear the dark. Anything might be out there. The unknown troubles us. But, ironically, it is our fate to live in the dark. Head out from the Earth in any direction you choose, and, after an initial flash of blue and a longer wait while the sun fades, you are surrounded by blackness, punctuated only here and there by the faint and distant stars. Even after we are grown, the darkness retains its power to frighten us. And so there are those who say we should not inquire too closely into who else might be living in that darkness. Better not to know, they say. There are 400 billion stars comprising the Milky Way galaxy. Of this immense multitude, could it be that our humdrum sun is the only one with an inhabited planet? Maybe. Maybe the origin of life or intelligence is exceedingly improbable. Maybe civilizations arise all the time but promptly wipe themselves out. Or, here and there, peppered across space, orbiting other suns, maybe there are worlds something like our own on which other beings wonder about who else lives in the dark. Could the Milky Way be rippling with life and intelligence, worlds calling out to one another, while we on Earth are alive at the critical moment when we first decide to listen? Our species has discovered a way to communicate through the dark, to transcend immense distances. No means of communication is faster or cheaper or reaches out farther. It's called radio. After billions of years of biological evolution on their planet and ours, an alien civilization cannot be in technological lockstep with us. There have been humans for more than 20,000 centuries, but we've had radio only for about one century. If they're behind us, they're likely to be too far behind to have radio. And if they're ahead of us, they're likely to be far ahead. What is for us technologically difficult or impossible, what might seem to us like magic, might for them be trivially easy. They might use other very advanced means to communicate with their peers, but they would know about radio as an approach to newly emerging civilizations. Even with no more than our level of technology at the transmitting and receiving ends, we could communicate across much of the galaxy. They should be able to do much better, if they exist. But our fear of the dark rebels. We conjure up objections. It's too expensive. But in its fullest modern technological expression, it costs less than one attack helicopter a year. We'll never understand what they're saying. But because the message is transmitted by radio, we and they must have radio physics in common. The laws of nature are the same everywhere, so science itself provides a language of communication, even between very different kinds of beings, provided they both have science. It would be demoralizing to learn that our science is medieval. But by the standards of the next few centuries, at least some of our present science will be considered medieval, extraterrestrials or no extraterrestrials. So will some of our present politics, ethics, economics, and religion. To go beyond present science is one of the chief goals of science. A serious student is not commonly plunged into fits of despair on turning the pages of a textbook and discovering that some further topic is known to the author but not yet to the student. Usually, the student struggles a little, acquires the new knowledge, and, following an ancient human tradition, continues to turn the pages. All through history, advanced civilizations ruin slightly more backward civilizations. Certainly. But malevolent aliens, should they exist, will not discover our existence from the fact that we listen. The search programs only receive, they do not send. The debate is, for the moment, moot. We are now, on an unprecedented scale, listening for radio signals from possible other civilizations in the depth of space. Alive today is the first generation of scientists to interrogate the darkness. Conceivably, it might also be the last generation before contact is made. And this the last moment before we discover that someone in the darkness is calling out to us. This quest is called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI, and I want to describe how far we've come. The first SETI program was carried out by Frank Drake at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Greenbank, West Virginia, in 1960. He listened to two nearby sun-like stars for 2 weeks at one particular frequency. Nearby is a relative term. The nearest was 12 light-years, 70 trillion miles, away. Almost at the moment Drake pointed the radio telescope and turned the system on, he picked up a very strong signal. Was it a message from alien beings? Then it went away. If the signal disappears, you can't scrutinize it. You can't tell if, because of the Earth's rotation, it moves with the sky. If it's not repeatable, you've learned almost nothing from it. It might be terrestrial radio interference, or a failure of your amplifier or detector, or an alien signal. Unrepeatable data are not worth much. Weeks later, the signal was detected again. It turned out to be a military aircraft broadcasting on an unauthorized frequency. Drake reported negative results. But in science, a negative result is not at all the same thing as a failure. His great achievement was to show that modern technology is fully able to listen for signals from hypothetical civilizations on planets of other stars. Since then, there have been other attempts, often on borrowed time, almost never for longer than a few months. There have been some more false alarms at Ohio State, at Arecibo in Puerto Rico, in France, Russia, and elsewhere, but nothing that could pass scientific muster. The Planetary Society is a 100,000-member non-profit organization that the planetary scientist Bruce Murray and I founded in 1980. It is devoted to exploration of the solar system and the search for extraterrestrial life. Paul Horowitz, a Harvard University physicist, had made a number of important SETI innovations and was eager to try them out. With support from our members, including the filmmaker Steven Spielberg, we began Project META. META is an acronym for Mega Channel Extraterrestrial Assay. The single frequency of Drake's first system has now grown to 8.4 million. But each channel, each station we tune to, has an exceptionally narrow frequency range. There are no known processes out among the stars and galaxies that can generate such sharp radio lines. If we pick up anything falling into so narrow a channel, it must, we think, be a token of intelligence and technology. What's more, the Earth turns, which means that any distant radio source will have a large apparent motion, like the rising and setting of the stars. Just as the steady tone of a car's horn dips as it drives by, so any authentic extraterrestrial radio source will exhibit a steady drift in frequency due to the Earth's rotation. But any source of interference at the Earth's surface will be rotating as fast as the META receiver. META's listening frequencies are continuously changed to compensate for the Earth's rotation, so that a narrowband signal from the sky will always appear in a single channel. Any radio interference down here on Earth will give itself away by racing through adjacent channels. The META radio telescope in Harvard, Massachusetts, is 26 meters, 84 feet, in diameter. Each day, as the Earth rotates the telescope beneath the sky, a swath of stars narrower than the full moon is listened to. Next day, it's an adjacent swath. Over a year, all of the northern sky and part of the southern is observed. An identical system, also sponsored by the Planetary Society, is in operation just outside Buenos Aires, Argentina, to examine all of the southern sky. In the Astrophysical Journal, Paul Horowitz and I detailed the results from 5 years of full-time searching with Project META and 2 years of follow-up. We can't report that we found a signal from alien beings, but we did find something puzzling, something that for me every now and then raises goosebumps. Of course, there's a background level of radio noise: TV stations, aircraft, portable telephones, spacecraft. Also, as with all radio receivers, the longer you wait, the more likely it is that there will be some random fluctuation in the electronics so strong that it generates a spurious signal. So we ignore anything that isn't much louder than the background. Any strong narrowband signal that remains in a single channel we take very seriously. As it logs in the data, META automatically tells the human operators to pay attention to certain signals. Over 5 years, we've made some 60 trillion observations at various frequencies while examining the entire accessible sky. A few dozen signals survive the culling. These are subjected to further scrutiny, and most of them are rejected. What's left? The strongest candidate signals after 3 surveys of the sky are 11 events. They satisfy all but one of our criteria for a genuine alien signal. But the one failed criterion is supremely important: verifiability. We've never been able to find any of them again. We look back at that part of the sky 3 minutes later, and there's nothing. We look again the following day, nothing. Examine it a year later or 6 years later, and still there's nothing. Although none of these signals repeats, there's an additional fact about them that every time I think about it sends a chill down my spine. 8 of the 11 best candidate signals lie in or near the plane of the Milky Way galaxy. The Milky Way is a flat, wheel-like collection of gas and dust and stars. Its flatness is why we see it as a band of diffuse light across the night sky. That's where almost all the stars in our galaxy are. If our candidate signals really were radio interference from Earth or some undetected glitch in the detection electronics, we shouldn't see them cluster toward the Milky Way. But maybe we had an especially unlucky run of statistics. Without repeatable signals, there's no way we can conclude that we've found extraterrestrial intelligence. Let's permit ourselves, though, a moment of extravagant speculation. Let's imagine that all of our surviving events are in fact due to radio beacons of other civilizations. Then we can estimate, from how little time we've spent watching each piece of sky, how many such transmitters there are in the Milky Way. The answer is something approaching a million. The nearest of them would be a few hundred light years away, too far for them to have picked up our own TV or radar signals yet. They would not know for another few centuries that a technical civilization has emerged on Earth. The galaxy would be pulsing with life and intelligence, but oblivious to what has been happening down here lately. A few centuries from now, after they do hear from us, things might get very interesting. If, on the other hand, none of our candidate signals is an authentic alien radio beacon, then we're forced to conclude that very few civilizations are broadcasting, at least at our frequencies and strongly enough for us to hear. Imagine a civilization something like our own, but which dedicated all its available power to broadcasting at one of the meta-frequencies and directly at our position in space. Then, if the meta-results are negative, there can be no such civilizations anywhere among the 400 billion stars in the Milky Way. But how would they know to transmit in our direction? So even if the meta-results are negative, the possibility remains of a broad range of civilizations more advanced than we are and broadcasting omnidirectionally. We would not have heard from them yet. On October 12, 1992, NASA turned on its new SETI program. At a radio telescope in the Mojave Desert, a search was initiated that will systematically cover the entire sky, making, like META, no guesses about which stars are more likely, but greatly expanding the frequency coverage. At the Arecibo Observatory, an even more sensitive study also began, concentrating on promising nearby star systems. When it is fully operational, the NASA searches will be able to detect much fainter signals than META, and to look for kinds of signals that META could not. The META experience reveals a thicket of background static and radio interference. Quick reobservation and confirmation of the signal, especially at other independent radio telescopes, is the key to being sure. Meanwhile, Paul Horowitz and I have given the NASA scientists the coordinates of our fleeting and enigmatic events. The NASA program is developing new technology, stimulating ideas, and exciting schoolchildren. In the eyes of many, it is well worth the $10 million a year that's being spent on it. The U.S. defense budget is some 30,000 times larger. Would I like to believe that with META we've detected transmissions from other civilizations out there in the dark, sprinkled through the vast Milky Way galaxy? You bet. To me, such a discovery would be thrilling. It would change everything. We would be hearing from other beings independently evolved over billions of years, viewing the universe perhaps very differently than we, probably much smarter, almost certainly not human. What do they know? The knowledge that other such beings exist, and that as the evolutionary process requires, they must be very different from us, would have a striking implication. Whatever differences divide us down here on earth are trivial compared to the differences between any of us and any of them. Maybe it's a long shot, but the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence might play a role in unifying our squabbling and divided planet. It would be a rite of passage for our species, a transforming event in the ancient quest to discover our place in the universe. In our fascination with SETI, we might be tempted, even without good evidence, to succumb to belief. But this would be self-indulgent and foolish. We must surrender our skepticism only in the face of rock-solid evidence. Science demands a tolerance for ambiguity. Where we are ignorant, we withhold belief. Whatever annoyance the uncertainty engenders serves a higher purpose. It drives us to accumulate better data. This attitude is the difference between science and so much else. Science offers little in the way of cheap thrills. The standards of evidence are strict. But when followed, they allow you to see far, illuminating even a great darkness. Long-range consequences of interplanetary collisions, by Carl Sagan and Stephen J. Ostro. As comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 raced toward its collision with the planet Jupiter, considerable public attention was being focused on catastrophic impacts with the Earth, in the past and in the future. In recent years, calls have been made to develop technologies that could deflect any asteroid or comet found to be on a collision course with Earth. But before devoting resources to this scheme, careful consideration must be given to the nature and time scale of the risk and to the cost-effectiveness and possible booby traps in the suggested means of mitigation. Comets have been associated with catastrophes in almost all cultures and since remotest antiquity. The first such argument with a modern scientific flavor was offered by Edmund Halley in 1688. He wondered if the Noachic flood could have been caused by tidal effects from a grazing collision or an actual impact of a comet with the Earth, and proposed, in effect, a comet-induced tsunami. Since then, the impact danger of small worlds has been a common motif in popular culture. Scientists have, until recently, generally responded with reassurances about the improbability of perilous collisions. The impact with Jupiter reminds us that improbable is not impossible. We know now that the Earth orbits the Sun amid a swarm of small bodies. Some 200 Earth orbit crossing asteroids and a much smaller number of Earth orbit crossing comets have been discovered, almost entirely by a handful of observers using small telescopes. These limited searches, in tandem with analyses of the lunar and terrestrial cratering records, have established that the population of Earth orbit crossing asteroids awaiting detection is enormous. There are thought to be some 2,000 objects as large as 1 kilometer in diameter, 320,000 objects as large as 100 meters, and 150 million as large as 10 meters. It is a straightforward consequence of orbital mechanics and probability theory that through its long history the Earth will be struck at typical velocities of 20 kilometers per second many times by these objects. Collisions with the larger members of this population are catastrophic. The greatest danger is from impacts energetic enough to inject so much pulverized soil and rock into the stratosphere as to darken and cool most of the Earth, regardless of the impact location. Unlike most familiar hazards, the impact threat works on many different timescales, all much longer than a human lifetime. On average, every millennium there will be a collision event as energetic as the highest-yield nuclear weapon ever detonated, the result of an impact of an object a few tens of meters in diameter. Every 10,000 years, one that may have global climatic effects, the result of an impact of an object 200 meters in diameter. And every million years, an impact event tens of times more energetic than the aggregate yield of the world's current nuclear arsenal, the result of an impact of an object 2.5 kilometers in diameter, enough to cause a global catastrophe and kill a significant fraction of the human species. The evolution of life on Earth seems to have been profoundly altered by collisions with such bodies. The best attested such event, and the single most important reason that interplanetary collision hazards are being taken seriously today, is the Cretaceous-Tertiary catastrophe of about 66 million years ago, in which all the dinosaurs and about 75% of the other species of life on Earth were rendered extinct. The events attendant to that impact are thought to include a global immolation of land plant life, widespread tsunamis, chaotic ocean mixing, a decline in light levels toward and below the compensation point of photosynthesis, below which plants burn more chemical energy than they store, short-term average global temperature declines of 10 degrees Celsius or more, global acid rain, significant depletion of the protective ozone layer, and prolonged carbon dioxide-induced global warming. The relative hazards provided by each of these factors is unknown, but it seems likely that a quick succession of environmental catastrophes is non-linearly more dangerous because organisms immune to or only weakened by one assault may be finished off by the next. Even an impact much less severe than the Cretaceous-Tertiary event would pose a serious threat to our global civilization. A conservative rough threshold for the diameter of a colliding asteroid that would cause a global catastrophe, and not just local devastation, is set at about 1.5 kilometers. Such a collision would release an energy equivalent to 100,000 megatons of TNT, disrupt the ecosphere, terminate agriculture, and likely kill more than a billion people. Refining current assessments of the impact hazard is therefore well worth doing, especially because, compared with many other activities of our civilization, it is so cheap. Assessing risks. David Morrison of NASA and an international team of scientists have prepared a report on how to acquire more information about Earth orbit crossing asteroids. They propose a project called SpaceGuard to identify and track Earth orbit crossing asteroids of at least 1 kilometer diameter. With the use of 6 2.5-meter ground-based telescopes spaced around the world, images would be recorded with electronic cameras and then studied with the help of computers to pick out comets and asteroids and roughly calculate their orbits. It would then be possible to identify those on collision trajectories with Earth in, say, the next century, and to subject them to more careful observation and analysis. The SpaceGuard team estimates that within 30 years, more than 95% of these potentially threatening objects can be inventoried at a total cost of $300 million. We have the time to conduct such a survey. The average time interval between civilization-disrupting impacts is a few 100,000 years, so the risk of such an impact during the next century is 1 in a few 1,000. A major impact would surely devastate the global civilization, but it must be understood in the context of its likelihood and the likelihood of other risks, catastrophic and otherwise. In the actuarial calculus of risk assessment, one combines the roughly 500,000-year interval between global impact catastrophes with the highly uncertain estimate that 1.5 billion people would be killed, mostly by starvation or disease, to compute an equivalent annual mortality rate of 3,000 deaths per year. This estimate is very approximate, but serves for comparisons with other risks. The annual global death rate from smoking tobacco is currently about 3 million persons, projected to rise to 10 million by 2025, and the number of infants and small children who die each year worldwide from easily preventable diarrhea and dehydration is of the same magnitude. With effects amortized, cosmic impacts are far from being our most pressing problem. A critic might contend that with limited global resources, the human species would benefit much more from global anti-smoking and oral rehydration campaigns. But the counterargument can be offered that interplanetary collision hazards are in a very different category from tobacco smoking and infant dehydration. The destruction of our civilization or the extinction of our species, no matter how improbable, are disasters of a different kind. If we take this argument seriously, though, then we must consider other hazards of the same class. Is there, for instance, a higher probability of the short-term destruction of our civilization from pulmonary AIDS, a hypothetical mutation or transgenic exchange in the HIV virus that permits it to be transmitted through the air like many respiratory diseases and the common cold? What about other possible pandemic diseases, perhaps caused by natural selection of microbes for resistance to antibiotics or the release of agents developed for biological warfare? What about unexpected positive feedbacks in global warming? What about destruction of the primary photosynthetic producers from increased ozone depletion, or the destruction of key ecosystems from the extinction of a few unobtrusive species? What about the world population crisis? What systematic effort is being made to identify all members of this class of improbable but extremely perilous disasters, and to demonstrate that the impact of a large asteroid or comet with the Earth is, over the next few centuries, the most dangerous of these contingencies? Countering the threat, it is, of course, sensible to seek cost-effective reduction of risks for all hazards to our civilization. Space Guard arguably constitutes a reasonable and cost-effective precaution, permitting us to refine our understanding of how serious and how imminent this threat may be. However, arranging in advance to destroy or deflect a hazardous Earth orbit crossing asteroid in anticipation that such an object might, against 5,000 to 1 odds, be discovered during the 21st century is quite another matter. Because of the time scales involved, the cost, and the possible dangers of developing the relevant technology. Since the interval between such impacts is comparable to the age of the human species, and since Earth orbit crossing asteroids are likely to be identified in a Space Guard-like survey many decades or even centuries before impact, there can be no urgency about taking measures to prevent or mitigate collisions. We lose almost nothing in terms of the safety of humanity during the next few decades or centuries if we delay the costly development of means of prevention until a threatening object is found. Indeed, it seems likely that technological progress in the next few decades or centuries will provide much cheaper as well as much safer means of prevention than any we can conceive of today. Proposals have been circulating since 1967 that recommend developing rocket and nuclear weapon technologies to destroy or deflect near-Earth objects on impact trajectories with the Earth. Nuclear weapons in space are explicitly forbidden by both the Limited Test Ban Treaty of 1963 and the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, but these strictures would presumably be relaxed if it were necessary to save the global civilization. In the most widely discussed scenario, the orbit of the near-Earth object is altered by exploding nuclear devices above the asteroid's surface near the closest point its orbit takes it to the Sun. This gives the greatest leverage. Although underground explosions will provide the maximum impulse, the escape velocity on near-Earth objects is so low that any single impulse change in velocity greater than about 1 meter per second would disrupt the body. In practice, for the most readily moved near-Earth objects, deflection requires several to many standoff nuclear explosions, each with a yield of 20 megatons or less. Even if a single nuclear weapon had adequate yield for such deflection, this is an unwise approach because of the irreducible errors in knowledge of yield and of how strongly held together the asteroid is, both of which influence the effect of the explosion. The only prudent approach is to herd a near-Earth object with a series of smaller explosions, carefully monitoring, perhaps with emplaced transponders, the orbital dynamics after each explosion. Some have also proposed employing this technique to insert selected asteroids into orbit around the Earth to facilitate mining their platinum group metals. Other methods of deflection have been discussed, including high-velocity kinetic energy interception, implanting a rocket engine using indigenous material as reaction mass, or attaching large lightweight panels to the near-Earth object to constitute a solar-powered mass driver. Although the following analysis applies equally to such methods, we do not discuss them further here, either because they cannot provide enough deflection or because the technology is unlikely to be available in the near future. We do wish to call attention to the possibility that such schemes in the real world and in light of well-established human frailty and fallibility might be very dangerous. The possibility of utilizing nuclear weapons to save the Earth has, unsurprisingly, proved attractive to some elements of the defense establishment at a time of declining budgets and changing missions. They tend not to stress the dangers of deflection technology. Los Alamos National Laboratory held a 3-day near-Earth object interception workshop without a single clear statement, even in passing, of the possibility that this technology might have serious ancillary dangers. But the whole subject is, by its very nature, inextricably bound up with policy judgments about risk. We contend that in any discussion of the deflection proposal, it is necessary to address explicitly whether it creates a problem more worrisome than the one it aims to solve. Deliberate misuse. Any method that can be devised to destroy or deflect an approaching large near-Earth object can be used, on a much shorter timescale, to do great damage to the global environment. If we can perturb one object on impact trajectory so it does not collide with the Earth, we can transform many near-Earth objects on benign trajectories into impactors. The latter is more difficult, but it does not constitute an orders of magnitude difference in technical effort. Given the current pool of about 100 known Earth orbit crossing asteroids with diameters as large as 1 kilometer, statistics suggest that only about 1 a century will pass close enough to be deflectable into the Earth. One of the best present candidates is 1991 OA, which in 2070 can be deflected into Earth impact trajectory with an aggregate yield of only about 60 megatons, according to calculations by Alan Harris of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Greg Canavan of Los Alamos National Laboratory, and ourselves. However, the total, still largely undiscovered, population of such objects probably numbers about 2,000. Were nearly all of them inventoried, as is proposed in the Space Guard survey, it might take no more than a few years to identify a suitable object, alter its orbit, and send it crashing into the Earth. There is no other way known in which a small number of nuclear weapons can destroy the global civilization. The technology for ground-based and space-borne detection of near-Earth objects, orbit determination, and automated spacecraft control and rendezvous can be expected to improve and diffuse rapidly in the coming decades. Rocket boosters capable of lifting 10 tons to low Earth orbit are likely also to be widely available, and nuclear weapons are in rapid proliferation. It is possible that in a few decades many nations will be able to detect kilometer and subkilometer near-Earth objects, determine their orbits with high precision, and rendezvous with them unobtrusively. We sometimes hear that this or that technology would certainly not be misused, or that only a madman would misuse it. We note that madmen exist, and sometimes achieve the highest levels of political power in modern industrial states. This is the century of Hitler and Stalin, tyrants who posed great dangers not just to the rest of humanity, but to their own people. In the winter and spring of 1945, Hitler ordered Germany to be destroyed, even what the people will need for elementary survival, because the surviving Germans were inferior to those who had already died. If Hitler had nuclear weapons, the threat of a counterstrike by Allied nuclear weapons is unlikely to have dissuaded him. If the technology to deflect near-Earth objects away from the Earth can with equal facility be used to turn inoffensive near-Earth objects to Earth impact trajectories, is it wise to develop such a technology? Might it be used not as a weapon of war between nations, but as a means for indiscriminate murder of multitudes? How sure can we be that it will not get into the wrong hands? A Hitler or Stalin? Some misanthropic sociopath? A religious fanatic hastening the day of judgment, some victim of ethnic violence bent on revenge, or technicians incompetent or insufficiently vigilant in handling the controls and safeguards. These examples from 20th century history could be multiplied many-fold. They urge on us a great caution in the development of potentially apocalyptic technologies. No matter what reassurances are given, the acquisition of such a package of technologies by any nation is bound to raise serious anxieties worldwide. A vision of a launch-ready armada standing by to deal with impact threats is not reassuring. The technologies in question are on a wholly unique scale, implying dangers never before faced by the human species. Surely those who argue the prudence of preventing catastrophic impacts with a probability per century of 1 in a few thousand will recognize the prudence of preventing comparable catastrophes from the misuse of this technology, with unknown but probably much higher annual probabilities. It is difficult, in the light of present global politics, to imagine sufficiently ironclad guarantees against misuse. It is true that there are some natural mitigating factors. A readily deflectable object such as 1991 OA would presumably be under continuous observation by many nations during its 2070 close approach to Earth's orbit. But will all dynamical data on such objects be shared with all nations? The need for multiple nuclear weapons explosions to herd an asteroid suggests that efforts to deflect asteroids may be detectable before impact trajectory is achieved. But will anyone be investing in the technology to monitor nuclear explosions 300 million kilometers from the Earth? Is it possible to explode nuclear weapons in such a way, shielded by the asteroid itself, for example, as to minimize detection from Earth? Distributing deflection technology among many nations in the hope that one would counterbalance misuse by another, or limiting access to those technologies to the United Nations, seems wildly unrealistic at present. It is hard to be confident that international controls on the misuse of this technology could have a reliability commensurate with the threat. The countervailing concern is that if we never develop deflection technology, eventually we will be defenseless against a devastating impact. But eventually most likely means within the next few hundred thousand years. If we postpone developing such technology until a threatening asteroid is identified, given the likely warning times of many decades or more, our ability to prevent the collision remains uncompromised. But if we develop the technology prematurely, then the opportunity for such an impact becomes much more frequent through human intention or inadvertence. What about comets? Active comets cross the Earth's orbit only a few percent as often as asteroids do, but because of their higher velocities, they can release as much as 10 times more energy than comparably sized asteroids. Accordingly, comets may constitute as much as a quarter of the serious impact hazard. Long-period comets approach on high-speed, nearly straight trajectories from far beyond the outermost planet. Trajectory refinement, threat identification, and mitigation are extraordinarily more difficult for long-period comets because of short warning times, a few months, and obscuration of the solid cometary nuclei by their gas and dust comae. The harsh reality is that mitigation systems adequate to protect against the long-period comet hazard probably are well beyond the current economic capability of our civilization and would introduce new risks that seem still more unacceptable. Of course, the odds are that we will have to contend with many collision-threatening sub-kilometer near-Earth objects before encountering a large long-period comet on collision trajectory. Over a shorter time scale, but still in the relatively distant future, it may become possible to deploy detectors, perhaps at large distances from the Sun, that provide comfortable advance notice of incoming comets. Our greatest concern may be a poorly informed public. If we embark on an ambitious surveillance effort, we could, in a generation, characterize the orbital elements of more than 30,000 objects at least 100 meters in diameter that cross the Earth's orbit. Thousands of near misses at less than one lunar distance will be experienced before one object on an imminent collision course is discovered. Maps will be published showing near-Earth space black with the orbits of 30,000 asteroids and comets, 10 times the number of stars one can see on a clear night. Public anxiety might be much greater in such a time of knowledge of near-Earth objects than in our current age of ignorance. There might then be enormous public pressure for means to mitigate even non-existent threats, feeding the dangers to which we have alluded. The only foreseeable solution is a combination of accurate orbit estimation, realistic threat assessment, and effective public education, so that in a democracy the citizens can make their own informed decisions. This is a natural task for NASA. In an indirect way, the threat of interplanetary collisions may have a political silver lining. They represent a common enemy to all nations and ethnic groups. By posing two different classes of danger to the human species, one natural and the other of our own making, Earth-approaching objects may provide a new and potent motivation for maturing international relations, ultimately helping to unify the human species. Can we know the universe? Science is a way of thinking much more than it is a body of knowledge. Its goal is to find out how the world works, to see what regularities there may be, to penetrate to the connections of things. From subnuclear particles, which may be the constituents of all matter, to living organisms, the human social community, and thence to the cosmos as a whole. Our intuition is by no means an infallible guide. Our perceptions may be distorted by training and prejudice, or merely because of the limitations of our sense organs, which, of course, perceive directly but a small fraction of the phenomena of the world. Even so straightforward a question as whether in the absence of friction a pound of lead falls faster than a gram of fluff was answered incorrectly by Aristotle and almost everyone else before the time of Galileo. Science is based on experiment, on a willingness to challenge old dogma, on an openness to see the universe as it really is. Accordingly, science sometimes requires courage, at the very least, the courage to question the conventional wisdom. Beyond this, the main trick of science is to really think of something. The shape of clouds and their occasional sharp bottom edges at the same altitude everywhere in the sky. The formation of a dewdrop on a leaf. The origin of a name or a word, Shakespeare, say, or philanthropic. The reason for human social customs, the incest taboo, for example. How it is that a lens in sunlight can make paper burn. How a walking stick got to look so much like a twig. Why the moon seems to follow us as we walk. What prevents us from digging a hole down to the center of the earth. What the definition is of down on a spherical earth. How it is possible for the body to convert yesterday's lunch into today's muscle and sinew. Or how far is up? Does the universe go on forever? Or if it does not, is there any meaning to the question of what lies on the other side? Some of these questions are pretty easy. Others, especially the last, are mysteries to which no one even today knows the answer. They are natural questions to ask. Every culture has posed such questions in one way or another. Almost always the proposed answers are in the nature of just-so stories, attempted explanations divorced from experiment or even from careful comparative observations. But the scientific cast of mind examines the world critically, as if many alternative worlds might exist, as if other things might be here which are not. Then we are forced to ask why what we see is present and not something else. Why are the sun and moon and the planets spheres? Why not pyramids or cubes or dodecahedra? Why not irregular jumbly shapes? Why so symmetrical worlds? If you spend any time spinning hypotheses, checking to see whether they make sense, whether they conform to what else we know, thinking of tests you can pose to substantiate or deflate your hypotheses, you will find yourself doing science. And as you come to practice this habit of thought more and more, you will get better and better at it. To penetrate into the heart of the thing, even a little thing, a blade of grass, as Walt Whitman said, is to experience a kind of exhilaration that, it may be, only human beings of all the beings on this planet can feel. We are an intelligent species, and the use of our intelligence quite properly gives us pleasure. In this respect, the brain is like a muscle. When we think well, we feel good. Understanding is a kind of ecstasy. But to what extent can we really know the universe around us? Sometimes this question is posed by people who hope the answer will be in the negative, who are fearful of a universe in which everything might one day be known. And sometimes we hear pronouncements from scientists who confidently state that everything worth knowing will soon be known, or even is already known, and who paint pictures of a Dionysian or Polynesian age in which the zest for intellectual discovery has withered to be replaced by a kind of subdued languor. The lotus eaters drinking fermented coconut milk or some other mild hallucinogen. In addition to maligning both the Polynesians, who were intrepid explorers, and whose brief respite in paradise is now sadly ending, as well as the inducements to intellectual discovery provided by some hallucinogens, this contention turns out to be trivially mistaken. Let us approach a more modest question. Not whether we can know the universe, or the Milky Way galaxy, or a star, or a world. Can we know, ultimately and in detail, a grain of salt? Consider 1 microgram of table salt, a speck just barely large enough for someone with keen eyesight to make out without a microscope. In that grain of salt, there are about 10 to the 16th power of sodium and chlorine atoms. This is a 1 followed by 16 zeros, 10 million billion atoms. If we wish to know a grain of salt, we must know at least the 3-dimensional positions of each of these atoms. In fact, there is much more to be known. For example, the nature of the forces between the atoms, but we are making only a modest calculation. Now, is this number more or less than the number of things which the brain can know? How much can the brain know? There are perhaps 10 to the 11th power neurons in the brain, the circuit elements and switches that are responsible in their electrical and chemical activity for the functioning of our minds. A typical brain neuron has perhaps 1,000 little wires called dendrites which connect it with its fellows. If, as seems likely, every bit of information in the brain corresponds to one of these connections, the total number of things knowable by the brain is no more than 10 to the 14th power, 100 trillion. But this number is only 1% of the number of atoms in our speck of salt. So in this sense, the universe is intractable, astonishingly immune to any human attempt at full knowledge. We cannot on this level understand a grain of salt, much less the universe. But let us look a little more deeply at our microgram of salt. Salt happens to be a crystal in which, except for defects in the structure of the crystal lattice, the position of every sodium and chlorine atom is predetermined. If we could shrink ourselves into this crystalline world, we would see rank upon rank of atoms in an ordered array, a regularly alternating structure, sodium, chlorine, sodium, chlorine, specifying the sheet of atoms we are standing on and all the sheets above us and below us. An absolutely pure crystal of salt could have the position of every atom specified by something like 10 bits of information. This would not strain the information-carrying capacity of the brain. If the universe had natural laws that governed its behavior to the same degree of regularity that determines a crystal of salt, then of course the universe would be knowable. Even if there were many such laws, each of considerable complexity, human beings might have the capability to understand them all. Even if such knowledge exceeded the information-carrying capacity of the brain, we might store the additional information outside our bodies, in books, for example, or in computer memories, and still, in some sense, know the universe. Human beings are, understandably, highly motivated to find regularities, natural laws. The search for rules, the only possible way to understand such a vast and complex universe, is called science. The universe forces those who live in it to understand it. Those creatures who find everyday experience a muddled jumble of events with no predictability, no regularity, are in grave peril. The universe belongs to those who, at least to some degree, have figured it out. It is an astonishing fact that there are laws of nature, rules that summarize conveniently, not just qualitatively, but quantitatively, how the world works. We might imagine a universe in which there are no such laws, in which the 10 to the 80th power number of elementary particles that make up a universe like our own behave with utter and uncompromising abandon. To understand such a universe, we would need a brain at least as massive as the universe. It seems unlikely that such a universe could have life and intelligence, because beings and brains require some degree of internal stability and order. But even if in a much more random universe there were such beings with an intelligence much greater than our own, there could not be much knowledge, passion, or joy. Fortunately for us, we live in a universe that has at least important parts that are knowable. Our common sense experience and our evolutionary history have prepared us to understand something of the workaday world. When we go into other realms, however, common sense and ordinary intuition turn out to be highly unreliable guides. It is stunning that as we go close to the speed of light, our mass increases indefinitely. We shrink toward zero thickness in the direction of motion, and time for us comes as near to stopping as we would like. Many people think that this is silly, and every week or two I get a letter from someone who complains to me about it. But it is a virtually certain consequence, not just of experiment, but also of Albert Einstein's brilliant analysis of space and time called the special theory of relativity. It does not matter that these effects seem unreasonable to us. We are not in the habit of traveling close to the speed of light. The testimony of our common sense is suspect at high velocities. Or consider an isolated molecule composed of two atoms shaped something like a dumbbell. A molecule of salt, it might be. Such a molecule rotates about an axis through the line connecting the two atoms. But in the world of quantum mechanics, the realm of the very small, not all orientations of our dumbbell molecule are possible. It might be that the molecule could be oriented in a horizontal position, say, or in a vertical position, but not at many angles in between. Some rotational positions are forbidden. Forbidden by what? By the laws of nature. The universe is built in such a way as to limit or quantize rotation. We do not experience this directly in everyday life. We would find it startling, as well as awkward, in sitting-up exercises to find arms outstretched from the sides or pointed up to the skies permitted, but many intermediate positions forbidden. We do not live in the world of the small on the scale of 10 to the negative 13th power centimeters, in the realm where there are 12 zeros between the decimal place and the one. Our common sense intuitions do not count. What does count is experiment. In this case, observations from the far infrared spectra of molecules. They show molecular rotation to be quantized. The idea that the world places restrictions on what humans might do is frustrating. Why shouldn't we be able to have intermediate rotational positions? Why can't we travel faster than the speed of light? But, so far as we can tell, this is the way the universe is constructed. Such prohibitions not only press us toward a little humility, they also make the world more knowable. Every restriction corresponds to a law of nature, a regularization of the universe. The more restrictions there are on what matter and energy can do, the more knowledge human beings can attain. Whether in some sense the universe is ultimately knowable depends not only on how many natural laws there are that encompass widely divergent phenomena, but also on whether we have the openness and the intellectual capacity to understand such laws. Our formulations of the regularities of nature are surely dependent on how the brain is built, but also, and to a significant degree, on how the universe is built. For myself, I like a universe that includes much that is unknown and, at the same time, much that is knowable. A universe in which everything is known would be static and dull, as boring as the heaven of some weak-minded theologians. A universe that is unknowable is no fit place for a thinking being. The ideal universe for us is one very much like the universe we inhabit, and I would guess that this is not really much of a coincidence. The Age of Exploration. We humans have enjoyed civilization only for about 10,000 years. Our species is a few hundred thousand years old. Therefore, for the vast bulk of our tenure on Earth, we were something other than sedentary and, the word has such an aura of self-satisfaction, civilized. What were we? We were hunters and foragers. We wandered in small, itinerant, extended families. Our current knowledge of the hunter-gatherer lifestyle is due mainly to a few courageous and far-seeing anthropologists who went and lived with the few remaining hunter-gatherer groups before they were finally and irreversibly destroyed by civilization. The anthropologist from whom I learned the most about hunter-gatherers is Richard Lee of the University of Toronto. He studied the Kung Bushman of the Kalahari Desert in the Republic of Botswana. I want to give a little flavor about our ancestors from Lee's study of the Kung. It is very important to note that they are highly technological. The technology is wood and stone and domestication of fire technology, but it's unambiguously technology. They are technological because their lives depend upon it. Chipping and flaking stone tools back before the external civilization sent a little trickle of metal into their economy is key. They did it superbly well. The archaeological and anthropological record is clear that we were technologists all the way back to the beginning. So the idea that science and technology is something new, unusual, and inaccessible to most people is completely backwards. Technology is, if anything, the most characteristically human activity, although, as I'll mention later, it is not exclusively a human activity. Now, hunter-gatherer game tracking techniques. A small group, with their bows and poison arrows and digging tools and a few other lightweight technological contrivances, is following the game. They come near a stand of trees. They take one close look at the ground. Immediately, they know how many animals went by, what their ages and sexes were, how long ago they passed. This one is lame in the back left foot. At the pace they're going, we should be able to overtake them in another 2 hours if we hurry. Now, how do they know all this? In fact, what do they notice in order to follow the game on which their lives pretty well depend? One thing is the hoof print. Different animals have different characteristic shapes of their hooves. Different sized animals leave different sized hoof prints. But the decay of the hoof crater, the falling of pebbles in, the collapse of the raised rims, debris blown into it, tells you age. In fact, it reminds me of nothing so much as determining the ages of planetary surfaces by looking at how fresh the impact craters are. Maybe the reason that studying cratering physics seems so natural to us planetary scientists is because we've been doing it for a million years. The Kung also know that animals in the hot sun like to avoid sunlight. If there is a shadow on the ground, they will deviate from their path to run through the cool shadow. But where the shadow is depends on where the sun is. And therefore, when you see the deviation of the trail from a straight line, you know that there had to be a shadow at that spot when they passed. Well, where in the sky did the sun have to be in order to cast that shadow? Oh, it was 11 o'clock this morning. Now, I don't claim that every hunter-gatherer made such a scientific calculation, did the trigonometry of the angle of the sun, and so on. This was tradition. Each generation taught the next. But someone had to have figured it out, and that someone had to be a scientist. This is another reminder that we've been scientists and technologists from the beginning. Consider now the important and rueful fact that every human culture has considered itself at the center of the universe. What's this about? I think it's very straightforward. Back then, in hunter and forager times, many modes of modern nocturnal entertainment were unavailable. Television was not available, so over the dying embers of the campfire, people watched the stars. Why? One, it is straightforward dazzling. We today, living under chemically polluted skies with nearly ubiquitous light pollution, have mainly forgotten how gorgeous the night sky can be. It is not only an aesthetic experience, it also elicits unbidden feelings of reverence and awe. Secondly, people made up stories about the stars. They invented Rorschach tests up there, follow the dots, constellations. Look like a bear to you, Og? Yes, I guess it does. And they forced their children to memorize these absolutely arbitrary patterns. Then myths were invented, either before or after, so these were visual reminders of events. That's the bear that ate your grandpa, something like that, and Gramps was put up in heaven as an example. But beyond that, there was something enormously practical. The stars, by their rising and setting, constitute a great clock and calendar in the sky. In the absence of artificial timepieces, that's extremely important, because there are certain seasons of the year when the herds are running. There are certain seasons when the trees are ripe with nuts or fruit. If you know what those seasons are, and you know what the moment is, you can prepare and you can eat. Now, the most superficial examination of the sky shows the stars are rising in the east. Some of them pass directly overhead, and some of them pass on small circles close to the horizon, but they all rise in the east, they all set in the west, and then in the daytime they do something else. They somehow go around the bottom of the earth that none of us has ever seen, it's flat as a board, of course, and then the next morning they come up again in the east. Now, there's absolutely no doubt from this fact that the stars, the planets, the sun, and the moon all go around us. We are obviously not moving, so we reside immobile at the center of the universe. An observed fact. Anybody who denies it must have something wrong with him. This is the geocentric conceit. Now, not only did every culture draw this conclusion, but our ancestors took enormous personal satisfaction in it. Think about it. We are at the center of the universe. The center of the universe is surely an important place. Not only that, what other animals, what plants make use of the apparent motion of the stars? Only us. Therefore, the stars have been put there for our benefit. The sun and the moon also have obvious practical uses. There was some confusion, though. Maybe you know the old story about the Persian wise man and philosopher who was asked, "Which is more useful, the sun or the moon?" and replied, "Of course the moon, because the sun shines in the daytime when it's light anyway, whereas the moon only shines at night when we need light." The centrality of our position was stunning. I imagine an extraterrestrial visitation of the sort that there is absolutely no evidence for, coming upon the Earth, which is running around the sun once every year, and then listening in on what people all over the planet are saying. "We're at the center! We're important! We're special! Everything goes around us!" And then I imagine the extraterrestrials thinking of the Earth as the planet of the idiots. But that's too harsh. Because there is a resonance here between the most obvious interpretation of absolutely straightforward observational facts that every person can verify for him or herself, a resonance between that and our emotional hopes and needs. The idea gained currency that the universe is made for us, not because of any particular merit of ours, but just because we're here, or just because we're human. To me, this seems to resonate with the same psychic wellsprings responsible for the view that our nation is special and the center of the universe, which, by the way, is the literal meaning of the Middle Kingdom for centuries applied by the Chinese to China. The names that countless ethnic groups apply to themselves, Kung, Hopi, Alemanni, translate essentially as the people. We're people, those other guys, they're something less than people. The same psychological roots that convince us of the superiority of our gender, or our ethnic group, or the particular melanin content in our skin, or our particular language, or headdress, or clothing styles, or convention of pulling out the handkerchief when we sneeze, or almost anything else. We have a weakness for chauvinism. Scientists are creatures of the culture in which they swim, and so we also are vulnerable to this chauvinist or geocentrist or anthropocentrist conceit. Except for a nearly invisible blip associated with the name of Aristarchus of Samos, we went on every human culture, every great philosopher, every scientist, every religious leader, thinking we were at the center of the universe. We put it in various guises in our sacred scriptures and declared the scriptures to be infallible, thereby making it not just a secular but a religious crime to question the conclusion. In the late 15th century, an astronomer cleric from Poland named Nicholas Copernicus thought he had an alternative idea, namely that the sun was at the center and the earth, like the other planets, went around it. He knew that this was dangerous stuff, and so withheld the publication of his book until he was on his deathbed. Even then, the way it worked out, when the book was published, it had a preface written by a well-meaning friend of his, Andreas Osiander, which essentially said, I'm paraphrasing, "Dear reader, when you look at this book, it may appear that the author is saying that the earth is not at the center of the universe." He doesn't really believe that. You see, this book is for mathematicians. If you wish to know where Jupiter will be 2 years from next Wednesday, you can get an accurate answer by assuming that the Sun is at the center. But this is a mere mathematical fiction. It does not challenge our holy faith. Please, have no anxiety in reading this book. This peculiar split-brain compromise actually lasted for almost 2 centuries. And how many other tawdry compromises between conventional wisdom and new ideas we've bought into since then? Finally, Galileo made a forthright and brilliant defense of Copernicus, based in part on a set of observations from the newly invented astronomical telescope, and the Church grew increasingly annoyed. Galileo remained obdurate. I once had the pleasure, at the behest of Franco Pacini, then director of the Arcetri Observatory in Florence, to actually tread in Galileo's footsteps and hold a close replica of his tiny telescope. It was so modest to have worked such a revolution. When Galileo became too insistent, the princes of the Church exhibited to him the instruments of torture in the dungeons of the Inquisition. They weren't making any particular point, they just thought he'd like to broaden his general perspective. Shortly thereafter, Galileo made his famous confession, in which he abjured the abominable doctrine that the sun and not the earth was at the center. But the stage had been set. Truth will out. The debates went on, and when in the 18th century Bradley discovered the aberration of light, and then in the 19th century the long-sought stellar annual parallax was found, the opposition collapsed. Now everybody is taught that the earth is not at the center of the universe. Except I think there's much evidence that we are all still covert geocentrists with a heliocentric veneer. Recent opinion polls show that 25% to 50% of adult Americans do not know that the Earth goes around the Sun and takes a year to do it. In China, the figure is 70%. Bear in mind that the Copernican perspective gets a lot of press in the United States, and still at least a quarter of us have missed it. And that in China, where there isn't a NASA, and where the television programs are much less sophisticated, a much larger percentage of people have missed it. If anything like China is typical, it may be that today, 5 centuries after Copernicus, most people on this planet still think in their heart of hearts that the Earth is at the center. So, congratulations on our wisdom in deducing our true cosmic circumstances may be premature. At the same time, that any of us figured any of this out is, I think, a legitimate cause for pride. In my view, a great deal of the history of science can be understood in terms of something like this Copernican debate. In many cases, the going-in position is that we're central or important. There's something fantastic and great about human beings. There is then actual observation of our circumstances. Nobody ever thought to look before. And then the result is the daunting and disquieting discovery, no, we're not at the center, no, we're not important. To my mind, many of the key findings of science, much of the modern scientific perspective, evolves from debates with just that character, what Anne Druyan has called the great demotions. For a long time, all through my growing up and undergraduate and graduate school career, astronomers believed that there were no other planetary systems. And if there were no other planets, while life has to arise on planets, then there's no other life, no other intelligence. And so, in this sense at least, we're at the center of the universe. One of the hallmarks of the age we live in is that this chauvinism, too, is in the process of teetering and collapsing. We find that more than half the nearby young sun-like stars have circumstellar disks of gas and dust, extremely like what has been deduced for the circumstances from which the planets formed in our solar system. The key datum is that the orbits of the planets are very largely coplanar. This was, by the way, something that Isaac Newton, no less, thought he could deduce the hand of God from. That is, God established initial conditions for all the planets in the same plane. But Kant and Laplace showed that the conservation of angular momentum meant that an irregular spinning, contracting cloud would collapse into a thin disk, and that planetary formation would occur in the disk, guaranteeing coplanarity. Not only are such circumstellar disks amazingly numerous, but we now have the first bona fide extrasolar planetary system going around a star that must be at the bottom of the list of potential candidates that anyone would have imagined. a pulsar named B1257 plus 12. This particular pulsar is something like an atomic nucleus the size of the Cornell campus, spinning at 10,000 RPM, 10,000 revolutions per minute. It's a supernova remnant. There was a colossal catastrophe that blew off most of the mass of that star. Going around it are at least three planets, two roughly of Earth-like mass, one roughly of lunar mass, a little in closer than the Earth, Mercury, and Venus. Recently, three planets of roughly Jovian mass have been discovered orbiting around the stars 51 Pegasi, 47 Ursae Majoris, and 70 Virginis. The processes that lead to planets look to be very broad and general. The technology is now improving so that in the next 10, 20, 30 years, we ought to have completed comprehensive surveys of the nearest few hundred stars, maybe much more than that, to detail what planetary systems they have. I think we can be fairly confident of other Earths among them. In short, we live on a hunk of rock and metal that orbits a humdrum star in the obscure outskirts of an ordinary galaxy comprised of 400 billion stars, in a universe of some 100 billion galaxies, which may be one of a very large number, perhaps an infinite number, of separate, closed-off universes. Many, perhaps most, of those stars probably have planets. In this perspective, how can anyone seriously believe that we are central, physically, much less to the purpose of the universe? There has been the view that if there is nothing special about us in space, maybe there is something special about us in time. We've been put here by the Creator to take care of things. Stewardship is the engaging word often used. Who knows what dire consequences would happen to the environment without us? So we have an obligation to make sure everything goes as God would have wished it. To me, the principal trouble with this idea is that 99.998% of the lifetime of the universe, from its beginning to now, was over before any human appeared on the scene. So, if we are the caretakers, where have we been for most of the time we were supposed to be doing our job? We have been terribly lax. I could see that the chief gardener might be very annoyed with us, which in turn might explain a great deal. If there is nothing special about our position in space or our position in time, maybe there is something special about our motion. We have a privileged frame of reference. This was the classical absolute motion physics that every great physicist bought into until 1905. Albert Einstein, all his life a keen critic of privilege in the social sphere, immediately mistrusted the contention that the planet we happen to live on was affixed to an imaginary frame of reference that had special merit with regard to the laws of nature. Instead, he asked, what kind of physics would be implied if you deduced the same laws of physics no matter what planetary system you lived on? Out of this question flowed special relativity, which is repeatedly confirmed by experiment. The notion of centrality and unmerited importance has been even more pervasive in the biological than in the physical sciences. It is particularly stark in the conceit called special creation. More than any other creatures, it asserts, the Creator of the universe has plans for us, key to the reason there is a creation. We're different from the other animals, not just in degree, but in kind. No one else has morals, ethics, altruism, compassion, courage. No one else can foresee the future consequences of present actions. No one else has art and music. Nobody else can use tools. No one else can make tools. This list, it goes on, is essentially agreed to by Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, Hobbes, Locke, all the great figures in philosophy, with the single exception of David Hume, hats off to him, bought into by all scientists, including highly skeptical ones, up until the year 1859, and enthusiastically adopted, of course, by all the religious leader of the Judeo-Christian Islamic religion. In 1859, Charles Darwin made the first and heroic effort at deflating this conceit, showing that one species could evolve by natural processes, without anything foreordained from another. More than a decade later, he published his second book on the subject, suggesting that evolution applies explicitly to us. He proposed that all of us earth beings are relatives with a single common ancestor. The implication that we arose through the laws of chemistry, perhaps out of primeval slime, was unsettling, to many repulsive. It stood in stark contrast to the uplifting idea, however bereft of explanatory power it may be, of the hand of a loving God. We and the chimps have a most recent common ancestor who lived a few million years ago. Chimps are our cousins. Even today, this contention upsets many. "Have you been to a zoo?" they ask. "Have you looked at what a chimpanzee does? Maybe you're related to chimps, buddy, but I'm not." Well, we can learn about human behavior in jails, and for exactly the same reasons. Prison doesn't bring out the best in us. When people like Jane Goodall devote themselves to observing chimpanzees in their natural habitats, the chimps get used to them. Then we find very different behavior. I can't resist telling the story of Geza Teleki, an anthropologist and student of animal behavior who wished to learn chimpanzee technology, particularly the termite fishing industry in which they are adept. So he apprenticed himself for 9 months to a chimp named Leakey, an expert. Here's how the chimpanzee termite fishing industry works. You find a reed, not any kind of reed, but the right kind of reed. You strip it of supernumerary branches, check that it has the right heft and suppleness, and then approach the enormous termite mound, an apartment house for termites. Each night, the termites cover over the entrances to their nests. The chimp takes a look, scratches away two or three places where the entryways have been walled up, takes the reed or grass stem, in one deft motion, inserts it into the termite mound, gives a few twists, carefully pulls it out, and the tool is covered with termites. The chimp goes yum, 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 and has provided herself an excellent source of protein. If a human were to be dropped down on his own in this same place in East Africa with a need for protein, how would he do? Teleki, spending full time on this problem for months, could not break off the right kind of reed. In fact, he had to use the reeds that chimps had discarded. He could not, after 9 months, find the walled-up openings to the apertures that Leakey could identify at a single glance. Teleki could not put the reed in deftly. For example, the reed would come out accordioned. Teleki could not wiggle the reed enticingly to get the termites on, and could not withdraw it without scraping off almost all the termites. At the end of 9 months, he had failed utterly. There is a bonobo, a so-called pygmy chimp named Kanzi, who lives in Atlanta, who not only knows how to use stone tools, but also knows how to make stone tools. Chimps know how to do things. How do they know when a human with a PhD does not? They were apprenticed for years. In the acknowledgments to Teleki's wonderful paper, he thanks his patient tutor and apologizes for his own failures because they are not the fault of the being he was apprenticed to. It's just that humans are not very good at learning some things. Now, of course, there are differences between chimps and us. We have electric light bulbs, police cars, compact disc players, and nuclear weapons. Chimps don't. But we can't say that they don't have any technology, and for most of human history, we didn't have these technologies either. Stone tools and fire were the technological frontiers. When it became possible in the late 20th century to do DNA-based sequencing, you could get a quantitative measure of the relationship between humans and chimps, and it turns out the two species share 99.6% of their active genes. One way to look at it, I guess, is to conclude that 0.4% is a much larger number than we had guessed. Another way to look at it is, if you want to know about us, study chimps. There's a lot to learn. In any case, the idea of special creation is really an idea from another time. If not much else but the molecular biological evidence were available, it would still be very clear that there is nothing in us that is qualitatively different from our nearest chimpanzee relatives, with the possible exception of a talent for language. Where are the battles on the great demotions taking place today? One is on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. We have not found life, much less intelligence, anywhere else, yet. We send spacecraft to other planets to look for microbes. We construct large radio telescopes and listen to hear if anyone is sending us a message lately. Both of these activities have led to occasional tantalizing data, but none of it of sufficient quality and repeatability to say that we have detected life or intelligence elsewhere. In our ignorance, the geocentrists find hope. They confuse absence of evidence with evidence of absence. You haven't found life elsewhere? There isn't any. Those who live on Earth are the only living creatures in the universe. You haven't found intelligence elsewhere? There isn't any. It's only here. We are at the center of the intellectual cosmos. While I could give you what I consider to be a strong plausibility argument why this conceit is also erroneous, it is only fair to say that nobody knows the answer to this question. We have not yet found life or intelligence elsewhere. We are in the course of looking. Maybe we will find it tomorrow, or maybe it will take centuries. Maybe we will never find it. All we have to do is keep an open mind. There is no other approach. You don't have to make up your mind in the absence of evidence. Finally, there is a new, and to my mind bizarre, field for this debate, something called the anthropic principle. It would, with greater justice, be called the anthropocentric principle. It comes in strong, weak, and various shades of middling flavors. The weak anthropic principle asserts that if the laws of nature and the fundamental constants of nature were significantly different, then the paths that in fact led to us would have been altered and we wouldn't be here. That is unexceptionable. It's certainly true. But the strong anthropic principle is, to my mind, dangerously close to the following argument. We would not be here if the laws of nature and the values of the physical constants were other than they are. Therefore, the laws of nature and the physical constants are as they are in order for the universe to produce us. God had us in mind at the time the universe was made, and here we are, back at the center of the universe, at last. There are many things that can be said about this. Who has traced through what other laws of nature and physical constants are possible and mutually consistent, but also lead to the functional equivalence of life and intelligence? You can also note that the strong anthropic principle is not very amenable to experimental investigation. There's something telling about calling it the anthropic principle, because many of the same laws of nature and the same physical constants are required to make a rock as to make a person. Why is it not called the lithic principle, with strong and weak versions? And in the strong lithic principle, the laws of nature and the physical constants are as they are, so rocks could come into being. If rocks could philosophize, I bet we would hear nothing of the anthropic principle. At the cutting edge of rock philosophy would be the lithic principle. I want to conclude with one of the many psychic rewards that planetary exploration has brought to me. There was a moment when the two Voyager spacecraft had completed their close-up reconnaissances of the Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune systems. The spacecraft phenomenally outperformed their design specifications. The bulk of our knowledge of the outer solar system has come because JPL did such a brilliant job with these extraordinary spacecraft, coming in on time, under cost, and vastly exceeding the fondest hopes of their designers. There were no other planets that we were going to rendezvous with further out in the solar system. It was now possible to turn the cameras close to the sun, and if the worst happened and we burnt out the optics, so what? There was nothing else we were going to photograph. I had wanted, from the time of the Saturn encounter, to take a picture of the Earth from the most remote vantage point. But it was by no means easy, even though the downside was almost nil, to turn the cameras back, and it required an actual intervention by the NASA administrator to get it done. It was clear that in such a picture, the Earth would appear only as a single picture element, a pixel. You would not even see continents. You could not tell any detail. I still thought it would be useful to do, in the same sense that the great frame-filling Apollo 17 picture of the whole Earth has become a kind of icon of our age. Because it said something very powerful to us, including the fact that from that perspective, national boundaries were not in evidence. From the outskirts of the planetary part of the solar system, it's a pale blue dot. That's us. That's home. That's where we are. On it, Everybody you loved, everybody you know, everybody you have ever heard of lived out their days. The aggregate of all our joy and suffering, thousands of confident ideologies, religions, economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilizations, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every hopeful child, every mother and father, every inventor and explorer, every revered teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there. The Earth is a very small stage in a great cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors, presidents and prime ministers and party leaders, so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of the corner of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one part of the dot on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of another part of the dot. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe seem to me challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that there is anyone who will come and save us from ourselves. It's been said that astronomy is a humbling, and I would add, character-building experience. To me, this is one of many demonstrations, through astronomy, of the folly of human conceits. To me, this picture underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known. If we have an indomitable urge to be central and important, we know what we can do. We can take seriously the admonition to compassion and loving kindness of the major religions that most of us profess to live by. We can work toward the economic self-sufficiency of the billion poorest people on the planet. We can make sure we know what dangerous predispositions lie within us and what desperate mistakes we have made in our history. We can make it unthinkable for our children to grow up ignorant. We can care for and cherish the planetary environment that sustains us and the other beings that share it with us. We can, every one of us, take a fierce and principled role in the democratic process. We can insist on the honesty and selflessness of our elected officials. And we can judge our progress by the courage of our questions and the depth of our answers, our willingness to embrace what is true rather than what feels good. If we want to be important, not passively because of the species or ethnic group we have by accident been born into or the planet we have been born on, but because of the merit of our actions, we know what we can do. This is Julian Lopez Morillas for Audio Scholar. Thank you for listening.